9/11 conspiracy, the World Trade Center, Twin Towers, and September the 11th, 2001 is written and read by me, Albert Jack. Chapter 1. World Trade Center Building 7. Possibly the most conclusive evidence that the events of 9/11 differ from the official report can be found by investigating the mysterious collapse of Building 7 at 5:20 p.m. on that day. Actually, it doesn't take too much investigation at all. Just reading through the facts available, including from the official report, will provide some startling evidence. We don't need YouTube rabble-rousers or online truthers to reinforce the case for a proper, unbiased public inquiry or a criminal investigation. The official version of events relating to Building 7 was released in November 2008 after a 6-year investigation by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, otherwise known as NIST, and it concluded like this. The National Institute of Standards and Technology last week released its final report on the September 11, 2001 collapse of the 47-story World Trade Center Building 7 in New York City. The final report is strengthened by clarifications and supplemental texts suggested by organizations and individuals worldwide in response to the draft WTC-7 report, released for public comment on August 21, 2008, but the revisions did not alter the investigation team's major findings and recommendations, which include identification of fire as the primary cause for the building's failure. The extensive 3-year scientific and technical building and fire safety investigation found that the fires on multiple floors in Building 7, which were uncontrolled but otherwise similar to fires experienced in other tall buildings, caused an extraordinary event. Heating of floor beams and girders caused a critical support column to fail, initiating a fire-induced progressive collapse that brought the whole building down. In response to comments from the building community, NIST conducted an additional computer analysis. The goal was to find out if the loss of Building 7's Column 79, the structural component identified as the one whose failure on 9/11 started the progressive collapse, would still have led to a complete loss of the building if fire or damage from the falling debris of the nearby World Trade Center 1 tower were not factors. The investigation team concluded that the column's failure, under any circumstance, would have initiated the destructive sequence of events. Now, for revisions to the final Building 7 report included, expanding the discussion of fire stopping, the material placed between floors to prevent floor-to-floor fire spread, clarifying the description of thermal expansion as it's related to Building 7's shear studs and floor beams, and explaining in greater detail the computer-modeled approach used to define where and when the fire in Building 7 started, and the extent of the window breakage as a result of the fire. With the release of the final Building 7 report, the NIST has completed its federal building and fire safety investigation of the World Trade Center disaster that began in August 2002. A 3-year study of the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, Buildings 1 and 2, was completed in October 2005. More than 20 changes in the U.S. model of building and fire codes have already been adopted based on the findings and recommendations of that investigation. NIST will now work with various public and private groups towards implementing additional changes to the U.S. model of building and fire codes, including those based on the 13 recommendations from the Building 7 report, 1 new and 12 reiterated from the Towers investigation. The complete text of the final Building 7 report, a video describing the Building 7 investigation findings, and of all comments received on the final draft Building 7 report, a chart tracking progress towards implementing all of the NIST World Trade Center recommendations and other materials may be accessed at www.wtc.nist.gov. And that was it. That was the end of the report. Now, I am neither a truther, conspiracy theorist, ranter, or raver, so let's just have a calm look at all of the main facts, whether we fully understand them or not, for now. Building 7 was occupied by the U.S. Department of Defense, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, the CIA, the U.S. Secret Service, the National Security Agency, otherwise known as the NSA, the Inland Revenue Service, the IRS, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the New York Office of Emergency Management, which was Mayor Giuliani's main command center on the day and who were coordinating the efforts of the emergency response teams in the city. In other words, it was already the most heavily protected and guarded building in New York City. Or it should have been. Number 2. No steel and concrete building has ever been completely leveled to the ground, collapsed, by a minor fire in the history of steel and concrete buildings, neither before September 11, 2001, or since then. The only officially recorded example of fires on multiple floors which were uncontrolled but otherwise similar to fires experienced in other tall buildings, causing an extraordinary event, heating of the floor beams and girders caused a critical support column to fail and initiated a fire-induced progressive collapse that brought the whole building down, as was stated in their short report, happened on that day. And not only has a building collapse of this nature never happened before 9/11, or since 9/11, on that day, it happened no fewer than three times. In the previous 50 years, there had been 100 uncontrolled fires in tall steel and concrete buildings, and none of them collapsed, except as the result of earthquake or subsequent controlled demolition. Point number three. The minor and containable fires visible on the 5th and 6th floors of Building 7 during the afternoon were caused by falling debris from Building 1 that punctured diesel tanks in the basement of World Trade Center Building number 7. 4. The 576-feet building collapsed into its own foundations in 6.5 seconds, causing absolutely no damage to any other building around it, some of them only a few feet away. Number 5. In April 2005, long before the final report was released, the NIST concluded that they had seen no evidence that the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 was caused by bombs, missiles, or controlled demolition. Number 6. The owner of Building 7, Larry Silverstein, the chairman of Silverstein Properties, gave a televised interview on the public broadcasting service after the event, during which he said, and I quote, "The fire department commander, Fire Chief Daniel Negro, told me that they were not sure if they could contain the fire, and so I said, you know, we've had such a terrible loss of life here, the smartest thing to do is just pull it. They made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building come down." Now, I know that sentence doesn't make sense, so you can make your own inquiry by Googling Larry Silverstein pull it, and you can see it on YouTube for yourself. That's exactly what he says. Point number 7. Silverstein Properties were also the owners of Buildings 1 and 2, the only other two buildings to completely collapse on September 11, 2001, or indeed in the history of steel and concrete construction. Important point number 8. Rudy Dent, a Vietnam War veteran, a four-year member of the NYPD and 32-year FDNY firefighter, was in the staging area close to Building 7. He gave evidence, several times in fact, that the fire department commissioner and Mayor Rudy Giuliani were inside the building until shortly before its collapse. He also testified that there were firefighters in the building who were calling for a hose to mop up some small isolated fires. There was no concern about the fires. After the building collapsed, Dent testified that he was aware of a molten, lava-like steel amongst the debris. Number 9. News journalist Jane Stanley was reporting live for the BBC and announced at 5 p.m. on that day that Building 7, the Salomon Brothers building as she described it, had become the third collapse of the day. It didn't go unnoticed that Building 7 was still clearly visible behind her as she made her report. Point 10. Men dressed as New York firefighters are seen on early live television footage ordering people away and shouting that the building was about to explode. World Trade Center Building 7 used to sit approximately 100 meters north of the Twin Tower complex. Between them, there were smaller buildings, 5 and 6, that were hardly damaged at all until the towers collapsed. And yet the official conclusion is that falling debris punctured a diesel tank in the basement of Building 7, and the resulting fire eventually led to a complete failure of the structure. And yet diesel oil can only ignite at temperatures in excess of 140 degrees. And, even if it did, what is the likelihood of a spark or flame jumping 5 or 6 stories and into a building to set fire to the curtains, particularly a building that's bomb-proofed and has air-sealed windows? Ask yourself how a small diesel spark or fire could penetrate one of the most secure buildings in America housing the New York Disaster Control Center, the CIA, and the U.S. Secret Service. A building that was gas-proof, sarin-proof, bullet-proof, missile-proof, chemical and biological weapon-proof, radiation-proof, and no doubt nuclear bomb-proof, too. In fact, it was designed in the first place to be a command center in case of an attack on New York by Russia or China. So, how do the curtains catch fire on the 5th floor after falling rubble from a building 100 meters away penetrates a secure basement and punctures a diesel oil tank? You might also wonder why there is no CCTV footage of any of this. All of these questions would be easily answered when the NIST carried out their thorough testing of the steel structure during their investigation. Just as in the case of any air crash investigation, engineers could rebuild the structure and then look for the cause of the catastrophic failure, especially in a case as high profile as 9/11, right? Well, wrong, because within hours of the collapse, the steel structure was being taken away by barges across the Hudson River and over land by a constant stream of trucks to scrap metal dealers. And they were the Hugo New Schnitzer at Fresh Kills Landfill on Staten Island, the Hugo New Schnitzer's Claremont Terminal in Jersey City, Metal Management in Newark, and Blanford & Co. in Keysby. 400 articulated lorries every 24 hours moved the debris in convoys. That is, one leaving the site every 3.5 minutes until Building 7 was gone. At the four scrapyards, 350,000 tons of steel were processed and sold, much of it to Chinese companies, for $120 per ton. American steel mills had been paying $160 per ton prior to that. In the end, over 80% of the steel structures removed from Ground Zero was on the slow boat to China before investigators had even had a chance to examine any of it. In fact, they were even denied the authority to impound any of it before it was shipped away. There is now, in 2018, so little doubt that World Trade Center Building 7 fell to the ground as a result of a controlled demolition, that it leaves one to wonder why the official NIST report concluded otherwise. After all, the building owner himself, Silverstein, told us in the immediate aftermath of the event that either he or Fire Chief Negro ordered the building to be pulled, pulled being a well-known phrase in the demolition community to mean demolished. Even if Silverstein himself changed the story during the same sentence between him giving the order and Fire Chief Negro making that decision. So let's assume that it's true, because part of it must be. There is nothing wrong with the fire department ordering a building to be pulled down if it was believed the fire was out of control. But even that is unlikely, given that Mayor Giuliani and the fire chief himself were still inside that building until half an hour before the collapse. And, according to eyewitness Rudy Dent, they were inside it for quite some time. There's also nothing wrong with an order to pull a building if it was considered to be unsafe and about to collapse. But that is also unlikely, for the same reasons. That is not, however, a decision that can be made by the owner of any building or even a fire chief in respect of a building with such strategic importance as Building 7. Not surprisingly, Daniel Negro has a different recollection of events and insists they claim, among many outrageous claims, that the building's owner, Larry Silverstein, gave the order for me to pull the building. He later said, "And that is absolute nonsense. We know that, Mr. Negro, but that only strengthens the case for foul play here." Either way, just imagine the sensitive information and equipment that could be found in the filing cabinets that might flutter all over the city after the demolition of a working building and not a derelict one. And imagine the sensitive information on the hard drives and networks of some of the occupying businesses and agencies. And yet nobody has said, and no report has ever been made, of a guard being placed around the demolition site overnight or at any time afterwards. There was no security there at all. Firefighter Rudy Dent testified that he was making his way through the rubble and noticed molten lava-like steel in the debris. So he and others clearly had access to the site. He didn't mention if he'd had a look around for any safes stuffed with cash whilst he was at it, let alone anything else, because presumably anything valuable or sensitive would have been removed before demolition. That's sensible, right? So, we are in the middle of one of the greatest and most chaotic events in world history, and Larry Silverstein, or the fire chief, it's not really important, who cares, decides to pull World Trade Center 7. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt here and agree that it would be possible for them to make that decision. How long, then, do you think, in light of all the facts we have, would it take for a team of demolition experts to obtain from City Hall and then study the floor and structure plans of Building 7? And using the latest planning software, they would then have to calculate the explosives needed and work out exactly where they would have to be placed. Following that, how long would it take a team to get into the building, already declared unsafe and with fire raging all around, and to drill or cut the explosive charges into the supporting structure with enough accuracy to bring the building down in only 6.5 seconds, and perfectly into its own footprint as well, and causing no damage to all the surrounding structures? Ask yourself how long all this would take, and then consider how long it might take for the staff of the CIA, US Secret Service, FEMA, and all the other occupants to get back in and retrieve their files and valuables and any other sensitive information they didn't want floating around New York on the demolition draft. Do your own research, like I did. The answer is, most demolition experts agree this would take at least 3 weeks of planning and preparation. Some insist it would be much longer, and this has become the subject of a heated debate, which just doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is nobody claims they could carry out such a comprehensive clear-out and then controlled demolition between being awarded the contract and completion in 25 minutes, which is exactly what building owner Larry Silverstein wants you to believe happened, despite the official report denying this multiple times and over many years. And if it didn't happen because it's not possible within that time frame, then it must have been a pre-arranged demolition where the charges had already been planned and planted. Now, this, of course, is also possible. It's possible that the building had already been cleared out, wired, and prepared for demolition on or around 9/11. This would have been the sensible thing to say in the first place. That's what I would have said. But they didn't. Why not? And finally, there is the seemingly incidental question of what information the BBC had been given for them to report the collapse of a building that was, until 20 minutes later, only suffering from small containable fires. As obscure as this detail seems to be, it is in fact a massive piece of clear evidence pointing towards a pre-arranged event. Unfortunately, it looks as if somebody, somewhere in the middle of the chaos of the day, sent an email to the BBC a little too soon. Perhaps the demolition was delayed by half an hour because Mayor Giuliani was still in there rummaging around and looking for his car keys. Who knows? It doesn't really matter either. The BBC attempted to explain this away by insisting that the live satellite feed from New York had cut off at exactly 5:15 p.m. and so they were showing slightly older footage from earlier in the day behind the news reporter who was broadcasting in real time. But that still obviously doesn't explain why she was reporting something that happened 25 minutes later, according to the clock on the screen, regardless of what was being displayed behind her. Could have been nothing behind her. It could have been a blank screen. By using Occam's razors process, we can shave away all of these silly details that really don't matter and keep to the facts. Was Giuliani in the building just before it collapsed or not? Who cares? But the time of the BBC report and the time of the event does matter. A pre-prepared demolition, whatever the circumstances, does matter, because both prove advanced knowledge. And there are also clear television pictures still available on YouTube of the men dressed as firefighters, they might even be real firefighters, telling everybody to clear out as the building was about to explode. How could they know that? Conspiracy theorists all shout at the same time. See? Clear evidence that it was pre-planned, screams every truther's website headline. But no, it isn't. And again, it doesn't matter. Use Occam's razor and shave that one off too. Because by now, we already know that something was pre-planned. The real puzzle is, why wasn't that the story from the outset? The easy and obvious story that nobody would question, would they? The two buildings, once known as the World Trade Center, or the Twin Towers, and Building 7, were the only three buildings to be damaged enough to collapse during the events of September 11, 2001. And they were all owned by one man, Larry Silverstein. Now, Silverstein is a Jewish-American property investor who bought the World Trade Center complex in April 2001. It was the first time in the building's 33-year lifetime that the ownership had changed hands. The previous owners agreed to sell the complex, valued at $3.2 billion, to Silverstein's company for only $124 million, because they knew the Twin Towers required a complete overhaul and restoration. Some of the materials used when the building was built 33 years earlier, namely asbestos, had since been declared a health hazard and the buildings had to be stripped. The New York Port Authority had long been aware of the asbestos problem at the World Trade Center and had tried on several occasions to obtain demolition permits for the buildings, only to be turned down. Asbestos dust could be deadly, and the city planners had refused to allow a white cloud of it to be cast over New York as a result of a planned demolition. Instead, they insisted, the buildings would have to be carefully stripped down floor by floor and room by room. The cost of this was estimated at the time to be $15 billion. The scaffolding alone came in at a cool $2.4 billion. So, the original owners, the developer, decided to offload their white elephant, having made billions of dollars in rental income over the previous three decades, for a paltry $124 million, which for them represented a cool return of $15,124,000,000 if you include the $15 billion they would avoid being forced to spend. For Silverstein, however, the deal represented an absolute bargain at $124 million for a $3.4 billion piece of prime New York real estate. If only he too could avoid paying that $15 billion upgrade cost. So, the first thing Silverstein did as the new proud owner of the World Trade Center complex was to replace the security company. Obviously, of course. Isn't that the first thing anybody would think of doing? The new company he employed was Securacom, now known as Stratasec, whose board of directors included Marvin Bush and Wirt Walker III, who happened to be the brother and cousin of sitting President George W. Bush. Securacom also had the contracts to provide services at United Airlines and Dulles International Airports, but more of that later. It was no coincidence, or for that matter secret, that the security company was financially linked to the Kuwaiti American Corporation, known as QAM, an investment consortium who, in turn, were closely linked to the Bush family, and had been since the first Gulf War when George and Marvin's father, and Wirt's uncle, former President George H.W. Bush, sent American troops in to relieve Kuwait of occupying Iraqi forces. And Silverstein, for his part, is a close friend of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Apparently they speak on a daily basis, who in turn is another Bush family ally. Another of Securicom's board directors was Michel Youssef al-Sabah, a member of the Kuwaiti royal family and a principal member of the QAM investment fund. The fact that the security of all the buildings, including the electronic access, the airline and one of the airports, all central to the events of September 11, 2001, were provided by Bush family associates was later dismissed by Silverstein as a coincidence. Of course, it was also a coincidence that the second thing Silverstein did when taking control of the complex was to insure the buildings valued at $3.4 billion for $7 billion, and specifically included a clause that covered each of them against terrorist attack. This is all a matter of public record. You can do your own research. Now, obviously, this insurance policy would not cover Building 7 or the Twin Towers for a controlled demolition. And this would be why that was never given as a reason for the collapse of any of them, which in the circumstances seemed to have been the best option at the time, as we now know. In the aftermath of the attack, Silverstein filed two separate insurance claims for $7 billion each by making the case that there had been two separate terrorist attacks in New York on that day. In the end, and after much debate and many threats, the insurance company consortium, there were over 10 of them altogether, paid out $4.55 billion, a handsome return on Silverstein's initial investment of $124 million, plus he now had a couple of plots of prime real estate land for sale once the authorities had finished clearing them up. He didn't even have to pay for that. Silverstein also received $3.4 billion of tax-exempt funds in 2007 towards the end of the Bush administration's final term to help with the rebuilding program. Where did all that money go? To this day, the Securities and Exchange Commission has not revealed the actual number of active cases of financial fraud it was investigating at the time of the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, after which its files of evidence were lost forever. But the Los Angeles Times have reported that an estimated 3,000 or 4,000 criminal investigations came to an end on that day. Much of their work at the time was paper-based and files were not backed up to a remote location as they are in modern times. Incidentally, remote data storage such as the cloud and Dropbox only became a feature as a result of the events of 9/11. In that respect, it is impossible to estimate how many corporations, bankers, investment banks and other crooks benefited by the losses on 9/11. Further still, there are over 200 agents of the US Secret Service working on one of the floors, and all of their evidence was also lost forever. Special Agent David Curran later admitted that all the evidence was stored in World Trade Center 7. All of the active cases went down with that building. And, according to the official and final report by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, it was all because of a burst diesel tank in the basement, which led to the curtains catching fire. And as for the Twin Towers themselves, while so much has been written about them and so many YouTube documentaries have been made that there seems little else to add. There were planes, weren't there? Were they drones or missiles? But there is a single piece of evidence in respect of the Twin Towers that proves the 9/11 Commission report to be a lie. You are supposed to believe that the aviation fuel from the aircraft tanks burned at such a high temperature that the critical core structure of the building failed, and that the weight of the top part of the building caused it to drop into that failure zone, followed by a concertina effect throughout the floors below, which dropped both buildings into their own footprints. So, in which case, how did the people on the floors above the impact zone manage to walk through this steel furnace wearing nothing more than a silk suit and down the stairs to safety? How were those poor souls we all saw waving towels and coats at the burning windows not vaporized like the steel was? And, as if it was necessary, let's also consider the witness testimony of three people who were in the building at the point of impact. Ling Yung, who was in her office on the 78th floor, a direct impact floor. She said, Only people in my area were alive, and those people were from my office. I figured out later, because I sat down there for about 10 or 15 minutes. That's how I got burned. Stanley Pranath was on the 81st floor of the South Tower. He said, the plane impacts. I try to get up and then realize I am covered up to my shoulders in debris. And when I'm digging through all this rubble, I can see the bottom wing starting to burn. And that wing was wedged 20 feet into my office. And Donovan Cowan, who was in an elevator, also on the 78th floor, was quoted as saying, we went into the elevator and as soon as I hit the button, there was this big boom. We were both knocked down. I remember feeling this intense heat because the doors were still open. That lasted for about 10 or 15 seconds and then it stopped. So using Occam's razor's approach and shaving away the improbable, we can then work out what we have left. The Sherlock Holmes approach. It shouldn't matter to anybody with a half-inch brain what the 9/11 Commission report says. We already instinctively know that those fires were not hot enough to cause the critical failure of those steel frameworks because we have seen the evidence for ourselves, and that cannot be ignored. If I placed a banana on the table and told you it was a grapefruit, you would have your own visual evidence and your own experience to know that I was not telling you the truth, unless you were 3 years old. So what did knock those buildings down? That doesn't really matter too much, because if you believe World Trade Center Building 7 was brought down deliberately, and you think you know how and why, then you have to believe that every negative event in New York City on that day is connected. Everybody can argue and disagree as much as they like about the Twin Towers, but that's a red herring. World Trade Center Building 7 is the key to all this. That's where the smoking gun is. Finally, Larry Silverstein had been holding regular morning meetings with his new tenants at the Windows on the World restaurant on the top floor of the North Tower. His own temporary offices were down on the 86th floor of the same building where his staff of around 100 were located, including his daughter Lisa and son Roger. There are many suggestions that Silverstein had been warned not to go to work on that morning, and they are claims that have been strenuously denied. I subscribe to no conspiracy theory here, but I do note that Larry Silverstein's wife made him an appointment at a dermatologist for an examination on that particular morning. And also that nearly all of his staff, including his son and daughter, were running late on that day. None of them were in the building when the plane struck. All of them had their own reasons for being late. All except four people, two of whom were brand new additions to Silverstein's team. I add these footnotes without personal comment. We can all do our own thinking about that. Chapter 2. The Dancing Israelis. On Thursday, September 13th in 2001, the New York Times reported on a group of Middle Eastern men who had positioned film cameras towards the World Trade Center in advance of the attacks. According to the article, the police had received many calls from shocked New Jersey residents claiming the men had been filming the disaster and then congratulating themselves afterwards. One witness stated, "They didn't look shocked to me, they were like, happy, you know?" Others pointed out the men were making fun of the disaster and taking photographs of themselves in front of the flaming ruins. Another witness reported them to be dancing with joy in a Jersey car park and were later jumping for joy in the Liberty State Park following the first impact. "They were happy," said one caller. "They looked like they knew what was going to happen and they were in Liberty State Park waiting." Now, could all of these sightings been of the same men? Or were there more than one group of dancing Arabs in New York on September the 11th, 2001? Another anonymous caller reported that he had seen a group of Palestinians preparing a bomb inside a white van and then heading towards the Holland Tunnel. This is the transcript of the 911 call. Dispatcher, Jersey City Police. Caller, "Yes, we have a white van with two or three guys in there. They look like Palestinians and they're going around a building." Caller, "There's a minivan heading towards the Holland Tunnel. I see a guy by the Newark Airport mixing some junk and he's wearing one of those sheikh uniforms." Dispatcher, "He was what?" Caller, "He's dressed like an Arab." Now this is curious because obviously not all people dressed like Arabs are Palestinian terrorists, so how could he have known? Or why did he think they were? In fact, Palestinians usually wear Western-style clothing, especially when they're in the West. So why did these men want to look like Arabs? The New York authorities immediately closed down the city's bridges and tunnels and issued a be-on-the-lookout warning for a white van in these locations. And there was a white Chevrolet van with an Urban Moving Systems logo which was spotted towards the rear of Liberty State Park when the first aircraft hit the building and the occupants were seen celebrating the explosion. And later, a van of the exact same description with suspicious, Arab-looking men inside which was stopped by police just before entering New York City. The Arab occupants were arrested at gunpoint and found to be in possession of box cutters, false passports, and nearly $5,000 in cash hidden in a shoe. Police also reported that the sniffer dogs brought to the van reacted as if they'd detected explosives, although none was found. It was concluded that explosives had been present at some point. According to the first local news report, which is now unavailable, and the subsequent reports dismissed by the FBI as unhelpful, the driver, Sivan Kurzberg, identified himself as Israeli, not Arab. He then told arresting officer Scott DeMarlo, "We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are all of our problems." The five men, Kurzberg, his brother Paul Kurzberg, Omar Marmari, Oded Elner and Yaron Shmel, were arrested and held in jail for 71 days. A big part of that was in solitary confinement. During this time, they were given as many as 7 lie detector tests, and most of them were failed. A search and arrest warrant was issued for the offices of Urban Moving Systems, and many boxes of files and computer hard drives were removed for examination. The owner, Dominic Souter, was questioned at length and then released. His lawyer insisted he cooperated fully with the police, but when they returned with some follow-up questions a few days later, he was gone. The company offices had been closed down in a hurry, leaving expensive equipment lying around and valuable customer property still locked up in the warehouse. It took some of them months and several court orders to get any of it back. Souter's New Jersey home had a for sale sign outside, and his family had already returned to Israel. Dominic Souter was later placed on the same FBI suspect list as hijacker Mohammed Attar and some of the other al-Qaeda sympathizers, suggesting that U.S. authorities felt he may have known something about the attacks in advance. Souter has now disappeared from the radar and only shows up tellingly in FBI files and during an internet search of conspiracy theory websites. Apart from that, he is nowhere to be seen, suggesting a false or changed identity. Steve Gordon, the lawyer for the five dancing Israelis, went on record as saying that his client's actions on 9/11 could easily have aroused certain suspicions. He said, "You've got a group of guys that are taking pictures from on top of a roof of the World Trade Center. They're speaking in a foreign language. They've got 2 passports on them. One of them has a wad of cash in his shoe, and they also have box cutters. Now, that's a very scary situation." But he insisted his clients were just 5 young lads who had come to America on vacation and ended up working for a removal company, and they were just simply taking pictures of the event. Vince Canestraro is a former chief of operations for counterterrorism at the CIA and who is now a consultant for ABC News. He said his interest in the case was heightened when some of the men's names were found in a search of a national intelligence database. According to Canestraro, many people in the intelligence community concluded that some of the detained men, if not all of them, were working for the Israeli intelligence. Canestraro also said there was speculation as to whether Urban Moving Systems had been set up for the purpose of launching an intelligence operation against radical Islamists known to be living in the city, particularly in the New Jersey-New York area. But, apparently, the alleged spying operation was not to be directed towards the United States, but at radical fundraising and support networks in the Muslim communities, such as Paterson, New Jersey, where several of the hijackers lived in the months prior to September the 11th. Sources say the Israelis were targeting these fundraising networks because they were thought to be directing cash to Hamas and Islamic Jihad groups responsible for the many suicide bombings in Israel. The Israeli government had been very concerned about the activity of radical Islamic groups in the United States that could form a support network to Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, Canestraro said. However, the men repeatedly denied they'd been working for Israeli intelligence and were, instead, simple removal men. Ram Horvitz, their Israeli lawyer, dismissed the allegations as stupid. Mark Regev, a spokesman at the Israeli embassy in Washington, put it more firmly when he confirmed that the issue was never even discussed with U.S. officials. These 5 men were not involved in any intelligence operation in the United States, and the American intelligence authorities have never even asked us about them, he said. He also simply dismissed the story as false. The Jerusalem Post later reported that a white van with a bomb was stopped as it approached the George Washington Bridge, but the ethnicity of the suspects was never revealed. Their story read, "American security services stopped a car bomb overnight on the George Washington Bridge. The van was packed with explosives and was stopped on an approach ramp to the bridge. Authorities suspect the terrorists intended to blow up the main crossing between New Jersey and New York." The New York Post, the New Jersey Bergen Record, and ABC News Network all reported that the white van was stopped on the route leading to the Lincoln Tunnel. However, the Jerusalem Post, Yediot America, and the Israeli National News Channel all clearly reported the van was stopped on the ramp leading to George Washington Bridge, many miles north of the Lincoln Tunnel. So clearly there was more than one white van in New York on that day, each at different locations and each with celebrating Arabs inside, as many credible witnesses have confirmed. It has been suggested that one of the vans was to contain a bomb and the other was to be used as a confusion diversion and to pick up the occupants of the first. Both vans had stayed clear of the Holland Tunnel area where the anonymous caller had reported a van with explosives heading towards, suggesting a classic misdirection move. And the police reported all five men were arrested in one van which had traces of explosives on it. So who was in the second van the police stopped? And where are the explosives? And where were the men driving it who were seen celebrating at some of the locations that the eyewitnesses reported? The bomb didn't go off, we know that, but two white vans were apprehended. Was there a third or a fourth? And how many more Israeli tourists or removal men were there in New York on that day with an apparent prior knowledge of the attack? Removal vans are commonly used in surveillance operations because they attract little or no attention. So was Urban Moving Systems really a cover operation for the Israeli intelligence agency, as the FBI suspect? The Foreword, a weekly Jewish newspaper, later reported that the FBI had finally concluded that at least two of the five dancing Israelis were Mossad agents, and Urban Moving Systems was indeed their cover operation. But by then the investigation had been quietly closed down after an order from the White House. The five men were taken from jail, driven directly to the airport, and deported to Israel. The CIA saw this as a cover-up and an effort not to involve Israel in any way, however large or small, in the events of 9/11. Amazingly, some of the dancing Israelis allowed themselves to be interviewed on national television when they returned and denied they had been laughing and celebrating. Oded Elner said, "The fact of the matter is, we are coming from a country that experiences terror daily. Our purpose was observation." Nobody asked him how he knew this event was to take place and why they had trained their cameras towards the World Trade Center in advance of a so-called surprise Al-Qaeda attack. This evidence alone, confirmation of advanced knowledge by Israeli intelligence, should be enough to cause good citizens concern, even without any of the World Trade Center Building 7 details. Did one of the Israelis make that call to emergency services about the Palestinian bombers and their white van heading for the Lincoln Tunnel? Did they then head for the George Washington Bridge, hoping to leave a time bomb before heading back to Urban Moving Systems? Perhaps they were not expecting the authorities to close all the bridges and tunnels which led to their capture and detention. After all, there must have been a fairly small chance that New York would close down all of the crossing points if they had specific information about an attack on only one of them. The disruption to the city would have been immeasurable, as it indeed turned out to be. And not to mention that since the confession on national television by Oded Elner that they were only there to observe, we now know that their Israeli lawyer Ram Horovitz, Mark Regev, the Israeli embassy spokesman in Washington, Dominic Suter, the spy master, and each of the five student tourist removal men dancing Israelis were all lying to the FBI about their activities and involvements during the most serious criminal investigation since the Second World War. But no charges have been brought and no extradition has been sought. There are people being snatched from the streets in Pakistan and waterboarded for much less. Following the attacks, the US Justice Department detained over 1,000 Arabs for small immigration violations and held them in jail. This conveniently kept the story away from the five Israelis, and the news media began reporting that they had simply been caught up in the same operation and were being processed before they could be released. Much to the concern and anger of local FBI men who had been involved in the arrest and questioning in the first place. What about all those failed lie detector tests, they asked, or the bomb trace picked up by the dogs? Instead of any real attention being directed towards Israel, Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network was immediately blamed for the attack, shifting the media focus from Israel before it even had a chance to get started. Directly after the first plane hit the first building, the director of the CIA, George Tenet, said, "You know, this has bin Laden's fingerprints all over it." The mainstream media never considered any other possibility, and all the attention was focused upon bin Laden and Al-Qaeda from the very beginning. Every news item linked the attack to that source. Every terrorism expert and every military analyst agreed, wisely suggesting the likelihood of an Al-Qaeda operation. Soon, and still without any new evidence, it was being confirmed that bin Laden was behind the attack. It soon appeared to the more cautious observer that a propaganda program was being wound out and no reference to anything other than bin Laden hating American freedom and democracy was ever made. Right from the beginning, the blame was all on medieval Muslims attempting to destroy our wealth and way of life and who are offended by everything good that we represent. "Well," said some, "all of this may be very true, but what about those five Israelis you have in jail? who knew about the attack in advance and had even set up filming equipment. They were the ones dancing with joy in the park. What about them? Even bin Laden himself denied any part of the 9/11 attacks and blamed Zionist organizations. Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Replied the television experts. In fact, this is bin Laden's statement to the BBC made before he ran off into hiding. I was not involved in the September 11 attacks in the United States, and nor did I have any knowledge of them. There exists a government within a government within the United States. The US should try and trace the perpetrators of these attacks within itself, to the people there who want to make the present century a century of conflict between Islam and Christianity. That secret government must be asked as to who carried out these attacks. The American system is totally in the control of the Jews, whose first priority is Israel, not the United States. Now, you have not read that in any of the US newspapers or quoted on any television network, have you? Instead, they told us that bin Laden had celebrated and accepted responsibility. Many senior intelligence officials, both in America and in Britain and Europe, have expressed doubts about bin Laden's involvement with 9/11. Rex Toom, chief of investigative publicity for the FBI, tried to explain why 9/11 did not appear in the detail of bin Laden's page on the FBI's Most Wanted website. The reason for that, Toom told reporters, is the FBI have no evidence connecting him to 9/11. The journalist wrote this down and reported it, but this particular quote didn't make it through to the final cut of any newspaper report. Toom's comment was simply buried. One senior CIA intelligence official noted, "This guy sits in a cave in Afghanistan and he's running the operation? It's so huge he couldn't have done it." Another senior military analyst agreed and suggested that given the size and scope of the operation, even the number of visas needed to infiltrate the team into America must have involved some sort of major foreign intelligence service. Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said at the time, "There is some very compelling evidence that at least some of the terrorists were assisted, and not just with financing, although that was a part of it, by a sovereign foreign government, and that we have been derelict in our duty to track that down, make the further case, or to find the evidence that would indicate this is not true, and then we can look for other reasons as to why the terrorists were able to function so effectively within the United States." Graham continued by suggesting that it will become public at some point when it's turned over to the archives, but that's maybe 20 or 30 years from now. But we need to have this information now because it's relevant to the threat that the people of the United States are facing today. And the Vice President of the US, Dick Cheney, himself conceded, "So we've never made the case or argued the case that somehow Osama bin Laden was directly involved in 9/11. The evidence simply has never been forthcoming." On September the 16th, 2004, four of the dancing Israelis, Omar Mammari, Yaron Shuel, Paul Kurzberg and Sivan Kurzberg, all filed multi-million dollar lawsuits against the US Justice Department, claiming false arrests, imprisonment and torture. Their attorney argued that the case would serve as a counter to any claims and theories that Israel had anything to do with the 9/11 attacks on America. The case never reached the courts, and nothing has been mentioned about it in the news media since 2010. The Israeli government were well aware of how the 9/11 attacks affected them and were quite comfortable with the outcome. In fact, when the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Larry Silverstein and George Bush's close ally, was asked what the attacks would mean for US-Israeli relations, his immediate response was, "Obviously it's very good for us." Well, it's not good, but it will generate immediate sympathy for Israel. Which is an interesting first reaction for a man who can list the President of the United States, a former President of the United States, and the man who owned the only three buildings to be destroyed on that day as his close personal friends. He thought it was a good day. Chapter 3 and the aircraft involved on the 9/11 terror attacks on America. Every commercial and military aircraft is fitted with two flight data recorders known as black boxes. One of them records every sound in the cockpit, including voices, engine noise, and warning signals. The other one records all of the flight data. That's everything from fuel measurements to speed, direction, location, and up to 300 other characteristics of the aircraft. The black box is vital for any air crash investigation because it will have the information on there that will reveal what actually happened. They are the most important part of any air crash investigation. And they are made from an indestructible fireproof material, which is one of the most resilient ever developed. They also have location beacons, for obvious reasons. Since flight data recorders have become part of every modern airliner, none have ever been lost as a result of an incident on land. Very few have been lost at sea either, but there is not a single case of accident investigators ever being unable to locate black boxes on land, except on two occasions, both in America, at the Twin Towers on September the 11th, 2001. None of those flight data recorders have ever been located, according to the official report. Ted Lepakovich, a spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board, went on record afterwards as saying, "It's extremely rare that we don't get the recorders back. I can't recall another case when we didn't recover the recorders." And yet, the 9/11 Commission report confirmed that none of the black boxes were ever recovered. And this is despite one of the New York Fire Department recovery workers, Nicholas DeMacy, claiming in his book Behind the Scenes, Ground Zero, that at one point I was assigned to take federal agents around the site to look for the black boxes from the planes. There were a total of four, and we found three of them. Fellow recovery worker Mike Baloney provides supporting evidence by confirming that he saw the men with at least one of them. And no aircraft in the history of aviation has ever completely disintegrated upon impact and left no trace of either itself, its passengers, or its cargo. Even when aircraft have been lost at sea, something has always washed ashore somewhere in the shape of bodies, seats, or suitcases. There have been no examples anywhere in the world of an air crash over land where no remains of anything have been found. Except on September the 11th, 2001 in America, where no traces of anything at all have ever been recovered from the crash sites at the Pentagon, and precious little was recovered at Shanksville, Pennsylvania either. According to the official inquiry, the aircraft that hit the Twin Towers both became embedded within the structures, and only a few small parts carried enough momentum to emerge from the other side of the buildings. According to FEMA, the pieces recovered from Flight 175 included part of a fuselage, a piece of landing gear, and an engine. All that was left of Flight 11 was a piece of landing gear, some life jackets, and part of a seat. Curiously, investigators also recovered a passport belonging to one of the hijackers, Satam El-Sakoumi. So that means the indestructible black boxes were destroyed, but a vital clue in the shape of a paper passport survived the fireball intact and fluttered to the ground where it was easily discovered. Meanwhile, the majority of both aircraft and their human cargo remained trapped in the towers, only to be vaporized when the buildings collapsed. And, just as we saw happen to the steel frames of the buildings, any remains were quickly gathered up and recycled before any examination could take place. Now, this is the official version of the events, not an interpretation. Do your own research, and that doesn't mean surfing conspiracy theory websites or nutters on YouTube. Read the official report or a summary and do your own thinking. I don't even want to comment here about the aeronautical engineers who confirm that the engine discovered that is supposed to be from Flight 175 is not from a Boeing 767, but from a 727 instead. You can look up the photographs of the engine and then check out the Rolls-Royce website and study their engine models. Because if it wasn't connected to the two planes that went into the Twin Towers on that day, then where did it come from? Who put it there? And what were they trying to achieve? I would say, however, that this piece of evidence alone should be enough for any thinking person to want to know more. And that's without the smoking cannon, bloodied knife, and bent piece of pipe that World Trade Center Building 7 is bending over the body with, or the dancing Israelis. And there's Flight 93 and the Let's Rollers. A group of American heroes, football heroes no less, took on five small Arabs armed with penknives and wrestled for control of the aircraft. These heroes sacrificed their own lives into a field rather than allow those dirty Muslims to crash the plane into the White House or somewhere equally important. Because they all knew what was going on because they had been called up on their cell phones at 36,000 feet and warned. Right? Wally Miller, the Somerset County coroner and one of the few early witnesses, told the Houston Chronicle, "It looked like somebody just dropped a bunch of metal out of the sky." Or, as he so eloquently put it to the Washington Post, "It looked like someone just dug a 10-foot ditch, took a scrap truck and dumped trash into it." As far as the passengers were concerned, Wally said that he stopped being a coroner after about 20 minutes because there were no bodies there. He said later, "To this day I have never seen a drop of blood at that site." And the first breaking news stories are always the ones that have the most credibility. They are the ones that tell us what the reporter actually sees and not what the news network or anybody else wants you to know. And you can see this with every serious breaking news story. Always make a note of what is first reported and then notice how the story will change over the coming hours and days, usually explained away and accepted as better information coming in. Well, you can't have better information than this. Fox News broadcast this first report between two of their journalists at the scene of the Flight 93 crash on September 11, 2001. Reporter: I've seen the pictures and it looks like there's nothing there except a hole in the ground. Fox affiliate reporter: Basically, that's right. The only thing you can see is a big gouge in the earth and some broken trees. Reporter: Are there any large pieces of debris? Fox affiliate reporter: There's nothing that you could distinguish that a plane crashed there. Nothing going on down there. There's no smoke, no fire. You couldn't see anything. All you've got is dirt, ash, and people walking around. There's nothing there. Reporter: How big would you say that hole was? Fox affiliate reporter: From my estimate, it was about 20 to 15 feet long, probably 10 feet wide. Fox reporter: What could you see on the ground other than that? Dirt? Ash? Affiliate reporter: I couldn't see anything. Just dirt, ash, and people walking around and a few broken trees. There's nothing there. NBC's own television reporter originally said, The debris here is spread over a 3 to 4 mile radius, which has now been completely sealed off and is being treated, according to the FBI, as a crime scene. This is one of those cases where the pictures really do tell the story. One of the most horrifying aspects of this is how little debris there is visible. All you can see is just a large crater in the ground and just tiny, tiny bits of debris. The investigators out there, and there are hundreds of them, have found nothing larger than a notebook. A Boeing 757? From 36,000 feet at 300 miles per hour or more? A 10-foot ditch with trash in it and no bodies. Really. Now, I have read reports from some locals who claim to have seen or heard Flight 93 smash into the ground at that location, and also I've read evidence from others who claim to have visited the site soon afterwards and reported bodies and awful wreckage. But when asked why this evidence had not been made public in the face of all those conspiracy theories, one of them replied, Well, it was pretty gruesome. Why would anyone want to see pictures like that? I wouldn't. I guess that's why they don't show them. Now, you believe that if you like. You can believe who you like, Wally the county coroner, or Willie the all-American homeschooled redneck. Parts of the wreckage were indeed scattered over a very wide area, which would support Wally the coroner's testimony. But that can only mean the aircraft failed and broke up high in the air, either through bomb damage or by being shot down. I hope it was shot down for two reasons. Firstly, if it was still possible in 2001 to get a bomb on board a United Airlines flight, then the chances are we're still not safe today. And secondly, if a hijacked aircraft was heading towards my home city of London and my family, then I really do hope the RAF shoot it down in a remote area before it gets there. But it doesn't really matter if Flight 93 was blown up or shot down, as the pattern of wreckage confirms it must have been. What matters is that the 9/11 Commission report doesn't conclude that. It insists the plane was fought for by American heroes who sacrificed their lives for the President and for the American people. And so, yet again, we can shave away all the nonsense surrounding the hysteria and use the evidence we have to form a conclusion. We don't know what that is because the flight data has not been made public, as it usually would be, but we do know that what did happen is not what we are being told happened. We all know that because the first reports from Fox News, NBC and Wally the coroner told us what happened, regardless of how those stories may have been altered since. And here's something else we know that many people have overlooked. We also know that the actual aircraft that was once Flight 93 was seen at Chicago's O'Hare Airport on April 10, 2003 by a United Airlines employee, David Freeman. He was in the habit of recording all of his flights. The tail number, serial N591UA, was, by then, identified as Flight 1111. And, what's more, according to the FAA, the aircraft serial number N612UA was also still valid, despite that plane crashing into the World Trade Center as Flight 175. Flights 11 and 77 are both listed as destroyed, even though records reveal they were not even scheduled to fly on September 11, 2001. That is, the actual aircraft, not necessarily the flight number assigned to it. As far as the cell phone calls between some of the passengers and their homes are concerned, there is little point covering that subject, because they didn't happen. Everybody knows that cell phone calls could not be made from those heights at that time. It would not be until 2004 when some airlines began installing the technology that enabled cell phones to work on passenger aircraft. Those calls were simply made up. When one of the passengers calls his mother and gives her his full name. When was the last time you called your mother and gave her your surname when she answered? My guess is that you don't even give her your first name. Hi Mum, it's me is good enough for most mothers. Hi Mum, it's Mark Bingham. I don't think so, do you? However, some of the calls from the airphones may have been possible, such as the famous call made by the stewardess, Betty Ong, who was aboard Flight 11. But reading the transcripts of them or listening to the audio, which has never been officially released, makes them so unlikely. In one of the few recordings to be publicly released, we do hear Betty, who appears to be calm and untroubled, say he is standing upstairs. Now, there's no stairs on a Boeing 767. And the final 4 minutes of the recording has never, ever been made public. And what's more, it's very easy to fake a voice by using simple voice morphing technology. It only takes a 10-minute sample of a person's voice to be able to make an exact copy and then have them saying whatever you want them to say. Anyway, all of this is small detail and it doesn't matter, so let's not get bogged down. What matters is the question of whether four aircraft were crashed on September 11th, 2001 at all. Some claim that not to be the case, and in respect to Flight 93, Pennsylvania, and Flight 77, the Pentagon, that is a perfectly reasonable claim and not a conspiracy theory. In fact, that those two planes were crashed at all is the conspiracy theory. In respect to Flight 93, we know that something broke up at high altitude and scattered evidence over a very wide area. But we don't know what it was, or if there are any people on board. We also don't know if it was either bombed or shot down. But we do know that no cell phone calls were either made or received at 36,000 feet, and we also know that the aircraft that was once known as Flight 93 was alive and well in Chicago in 2004. Even the FAA don't even list it as destroyed. So we don't know what did happen, but we're starting to understand what didn't happen. And that can be found within the text of the 9/11 Commission report, which is looking, by the way, as the real conspiracy. Flight 11, the one with the confusing Betty Ong phone calls. A USAF fighter jet pilot who was patrolling the skies over New York City reported at 9:24 that he identified Flight 11, supposedly having crashed into the North Tower at 8:46, via his radar equipment, which displays the flight numbers. It was heading southbound towards Washington, D.C. Now this means one of only three things. Either the radar was being manipulated, pilot error on his part, or he really did see Flight 11 heading south towards Washington, D.C. at 9:24. 45 minutes after the supposed impact. Shave away all of the improbable, the unlikely, the impossible, the conspiracy theories, and the official account, and you are just left with these three possibilities: pilot error, radar manipulation, or Flight 11 being alive and well and heading south. And we can almost certainly rule out pilot error. Almost. Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon, according to the official report, is not so complicated to address because there are no cell phone transcripts to mull over and dissemble. In fact, there is very little information at all. We don't even have an aircraft. The first live news reports to be broadcast from the Pentagon on September the 11th were made by CNN television journalist Dan Rather, who was asked by the studio how much of the plane actually impacted the building. Rather responded, "You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection there is no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the side of the building that is actually crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left are so small you can pick them up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around which would indicate that an entire plane has crashed into the side of the Pentagon and caused the side of it to collapse." Rather continued, "Now, even if you look at the pictures, you can see the floors have all collapsed, but that didn't happen immediately. It wasn't until about 45 minutes later that the structure was weakened enough to cause the floors to collapse." Indeed, looking at the scene behind Rather as he makes his live broadcast, there is no sign of an aircraft either on the lawn behind him or in the side of the Pentagon. For that matter, there is also no sign of the immaculate lawn being disturbed by a Boeing 757 screaming at 530 miles an hour, 5 feet above it either. You may also have seen the later pictures of aircraft parts scattered around or being retrieved, but look at the first response. Watch the first live news broadcasts from the scene and listen to what Rather says. Don't take my word for it. It's on YouTube. Listen to it yourself. And then there was the footage that was never broadcast but has found its way onto the internet of Rather questioning a witness who insisted, "No, it wasn't a second plane. It was a bomb in the building. There is no second plane." The witness looks genuinely confused and troubled. He frowns as he asks Rather, "Who says it was a second plane? It was a bomb." Rather then looks around and replies, "I don't know." But the witness insists again more forcefully and says, "Who said it was a second plane?" Rather walks away saying, "That's what we were told, a second plane. We saw it on television." But the witness argues again, "No, it was a bomb. I saw everything." Throughout this clip, the screen is displaying the caption, "Planes crash into Pentagon, both World Trade Towers." Somebody at CNN had already decided that. Whilst there was no plane at the Pentagon, and if there had been, then one of the 86 security cameras in that area of the building would have provided evidence by now, there certainly were aircraft that crashed into the Twin Towers in New York. At the Pentagon, there were a few small pieces of wreckage that were later photographed, such as a 2-foot-wide engine, but these are red herrings. A 60-ton Boeing 757 has two engines that are each 9 feet in diameter and virtually indestructible, certainly by fire or impact. One engine alone would have made a hole as large as the one in the side of the Pentagon that we were told the entire aircraft disappeared into. We could go on and on, poring over the small details such as what was that tiny engine doing there and who put it there, but why bother, and who cares? The bigger story is that the 9/11 Commission report is lying again, and it's plain to see. The early reports prove it. The conspiracy theories claim that the engine comes from a single-engined military drone, and it may well have done. But we don't know that for sure, and probably never will, so let's stay with what we can confirm and not be sidetracked for now. Let's pause and reflect on what that is. What we have left after we have shaved away all the conspiracies, the name-calling, the side-taking, and the holier-than-thou rancor. We have World Trade Center Building 7 looking a bit sheepish. We have the men in silk suits being able to walk through the steel mill furnace in the Twin Towers that was hot enough to cause the catastrophic failure in the steel structure. Those two things alone are enough to discredit the 9/11 Commission report. And then there is Flight 93 that couldn't have crashed into a 10 or 20 foot hole and vaporized. It has never happened in the history of aviation, and it didn't happen on 9/11 either. And we have the US Air Force pilot reporting that Flight 11 was alive and well and heading south. Or was that radar manipulation? And we have the dancing Israelis who confirm they had advanced knowledge of the attacks and were there to record it. And we see Dan Rather's early news reports from the Pentagon confirming there was no plane there. And the witness he interviewed insisting there was no plane, but instead it was a bomb. And that was after CNN had changed Rather's first story and reported a plane was there after all, somewhere, even though nobody saw it. Now this is the point where most people cry, "But why? Are you really suggesting this whole thing was an inside job? The government planned to attack its own people for a mandate to go to war in Afghanistan and Iraq over oil or something else. Too many people would have to be involved and somehow the truth would emerge." Well, the answer to that is no, I'm not suggesting anything of the sort. For a start, I think the Bush administration was far too stupid to attempt anything so complicated, or even to think it up in the first place, but so was Bin Laden and his cavemen. But by using Occam's razor and shaving away all the silly detail that has been argued about for over 15 years and revealing a few of the actual facts, we do know that the official 9/11 Commission report is a cover-up. It's a lie, and that is obvious, but who is it covering for? If it's not the Bush administration, we need to look again at the smoking gun that is World Trade Center Building 7, because if we know who is responsible for that, then we find out who's responsible for all of it. Chapter 4. The Pentagon. Now something hit the most heavily and cleverly defended building in the history of mankind, and the 9/11 Commission report tells us it was United Airlines Flight 77. And try not to pay too much attention to conspiracy theorists who point to nuts and bolts that don't match because the threads are different sizes, because none of that matters. We all have nuts and bolts in our sheds that don't match because the threads are different sizes. Who cares? Concentrate here instead on the bigger questions. Ask the bigger questions. 19 underqualified Arabs taking over 4 American passenger jets armed with nothing more than penknives and hitting 3/4 of their targets is the real conspiracy theory. There is no visible evidence or no credible witness evidence that any passenger airline jet crashed into the side of the Pentagon on September the 11th, 2001. Something happened, obviously, but it didn't involve Flight 77. The only real information released was provided by US Solicitor General in the Bush administration, Theodore Ted Olson, whose wife Barbara, herself a well-known television personality, was on the flight, we're told. Now, Olson claims she called him twice from the aircraft at around 30 minutes before the incident at the Pentagon. He told CNN that his wife had made the calls from her cell phone and told him that all passengers and flight crew, including the pilots, had been herded to the back of the plane by armed hijackers. She told him they had knives and cardboard cutters. Remember, this is the US Solicitor General, and we already know that cell phones don't work at altitude. The FBI's record of their interview with Olson reads that he, Olson, doesn't know if the calls were made by his wife's cell phone or the telephone on the plane. However, during an interview with Hannity and Combs on September the 14th, 2001, Mr. Olson insisted that his wife made the calls using the airline phone. Over the course of the following years, he's alternated his evidence between the two options. We also know that until January the 31st, 2001, United Airlines had no airphones installed on any Boeing 757, and they were known to be still unreliable by September. Ted Olson claimed his wife called him collect, which to those of you outside America means she reversed the charges. So ask yourself how, and then why. How do you reverse the charge on a cell phone, and why would you do that in those circumstances, even if you could? Then he changed his story and said that his wife had used the airphone instead to call him collect, which you couldn't do in 2001 and you still can't do today. Airphones need to be activated by swiping a credit card, which is then charged for the call. We don't really know what any of this means at all. However, the FBI confirmed a few years later that Barbara Olson's calls to her husband on that day lasted for exactly 0 seconds. Now that tells us something. It tells us that the esteemed US Solicitor General had been lying, repeatedly. Although he doesn't tell us why and he's clearly never going to. Two more facts relating to the Olsons. Barbara Olson was Jewish and graduated from the Yeshiva University Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law. Her husband Ted was a prominent lawyer who represented an Israeli spy and Mossad agent, Jonathan Pollard, who was convicted by an American court in 1986 for passing top-secret information to Israel. He was sentenced to life in 1987 and remains in prison to this day. And both Olsons had close links to Mossad, the Israeli secret service. One last thing in relation to the Olsons involves doing your own research. Compare the similarities between Barbara Olson and Ted Olson's new wife, Lady Booth Olson. That's not a title, that's her Christian name. Compare their backgrounds, professional abilities, and looks. And while you're doing that, remember that no aircraft hit the Pentagon on September the 11th, 2001, and so she should be alive and well somewhere. I draw no public conclusions here and only ask you to make your own. But if you're thinking what I'm thinking, then why is that idea any more far-fetched than what we're being led to believe by the original, official 9/11 Commission report? Chapter 5. The Hijackers. 19 young Arab men were able to board 4 American domestic passenger jets and, armed only with Stanley knives or modelling knives, were able to overpower the crew and passengers of each plane. 4 of them had received flight training on simulators in America and, despite not being able to speak English, had learned enough to take over the controls of each plane. And they had learned enough to know how to switch off the transponders and autopilot and manage to steer aircraft they have never flown before single-handedly into very small targets with minute precision many, many miles away. So what we actually know is that in the first place their names did not appear on any passenger list, and that is not an easy thing to arrange. There are no cases prior to 9/11 of any passenger ever being able to board a commercial airline without being checked in. On September the 11th, 2001, this happened 19 times. There have been no cases since 9/11. So actually, there is no proof of any kind that they were even on board. Their names have appeared on the passenger lists subsequently posted on the internet since 9/11, but were not at the time. Even the passport found on the street in New York is not proof that Sattam al-Sukami was up there in that inferno. If anything, finding his perfectly preserved passport on the street might suggest that he couldn't have been up there, or had it been lost or stolen and coincidentally dropped in New York on that day. What an incredible coincidence that would be. Or was he already on the ground and dropped it himself, maybe deliberately? But there's no tangible proof any of them were on any of the aircraft. It's only what we've been told. Interestingly, 7 of them were still alive after 9/11 and living in the Middle East or Africa. Pilot Walid al-Shehari was interviewed by the BBC on September the 23rd in Casablanca, Morocco, and was obviously protesting his innocence. He was quite convincing given the fact that he was not dead. He told journalists there that he had nothing to do with the attacks on New York and Washington and had been in Morocco when they happened. He had contacted both the Saudi and American authorities to report his innocence. He claimed his brother Whale, another named as one of the hijackers of Flight 11, was also still alive. Abdul Aziz Al-Omari, an alleged Flight 11 hijacker, is still alive too, and working as an engineer with Saudi Telecoms. He claims he lost his passport in Denver, and obviously would have had to report this to the authorities, or he wouldn't have been able to travel back to Saudi Arabia. So, the American authorities knew his passport had been lost or stolen, but he was still named as a hijacker. Another man of the same name is also still alive and is a pilot working for the Saudi Arabian Airlines. A London newspaper interviewed Saeed Al-Ghamdi after 9/11, and they too confirmed that announcements of his death had been premature. The same goes for Amin al-Nami, Salim al-Halzami, and Muhammad al-Shahari, who were all alive and well long after September 11, 2001. Despite all this evidence, the FBI have not revised their list of hijackers. The FBI told reporters they were able to identify the hijackers so quickly because they discovered a list of their names in luggage that Mohammed Attar had left behind in a rental car. Apparently the list was in a case along with a terrorist manual with instructions of how to hijack a passenger aircraft. And how did they find Attar's rental car so quickly? Well, we are told the authorities received an anonymous tip about a suspicious-looking white car parked at Logan Airport. I wonder what looks so suspicious about a white rental car parked at Logan Airport among tens of thousands of other similar-looking white cars. Was it upside down? Was it on fire? How could it look suspicious? And there has also been cockpit recordings released of the terrorist Muslim hijackers chanting Allah Akbar, which translates as God is great. But, according to Muslim scholars, the final words of a devout follower of Islam should be, "There is but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet." Would they get their important final words so wrong? Well, possibly. But in direct contradiction to that FBI briefing, there is now information of an earlier list of suspects that the FBI put together from their first look through the flight manifests. They then began to investigate the movements immediately prior to the attacks of Muhammad Attar, Adnan Bukhari, Amir Bukhari, Abdul Alumari, and Amir Kamfar. All of these men, with the exception of Atta, were Saudi Arabian pilots living in Vero Beach, Florida. Abdul Alomari lived with his family in the same house as Amir Kamfar. Right next door was Adnan Bukhari and his family, who had Amir Bukhari, thought at that time to be his brother, staying with them. Mohammed Attar was the only one on this first list who was not qualified as a pilot, although he was known to have received flight training at Huffman Aviation, among other flight schools. At 5 a.m. on the morning of September 12, 2001, a police SWAT team stormed into Adnan Bukhari's house, only to be surprised to find him eating breakfast and watching news coverage of the previous day's events. But they arrested him anyway after claiming that his identity card and that of his brother Amir had been discovered in a rental car left behind by known hijackers in Portland, Maine. This raises other questions, because as the FBI clearly didn't know who the hijackers were at this stage, then how would they know where their cars were parked? Maybe that's not important. What is important is that Amir Bukhari, who was not related and not living at the same address after all, had died a year earlier. Despite finding all this out, the agents still evacuated the surrounding streets and claimed that the house was rigged with explosives. After passing polygraph tests and providing credible alibis, Bukhari was released and allowed to go home. He was lucky. He would have been sent to Guantanamo Bay if it had been ready by then. Abdul Alumari and Amir Kamfar were also still alive and well, but not living next door after all. They were in Saudi Arabia. Instead, the police SWAT team invaded the house of an entirely innocent family. Only Mohammed Attar was unaccounted for, and therefore became the first name on the second list, the one we all saw on the front pages of our newspapers the very following morning. However, these two lists of suspects were then and are still now at least partially wrong. From the first list, only Attar could have been involved, and from the second, well, seven of those suspects were still alive on September 12. Remember, Attar's name came up on a search of a passenger list along with four other Arabs who were already dead or still alive afterwards, which means the hijackers were using false identities in four out of the five examples. The second list was compiled after the FBI claimed they had traced Attar's hire car and inside found a bomb-making manual. Why would he need one of those? And a convenient, complete list of the 19 names of all the actual men who are allegedly involved. So now let's add in the crucial details of some other things that we actually know. Mohammed Attar's name did not appear on any flight manifest that made up the initial list of five suspects. So where did his name come from? One of them was already dead, three of them were still alive, and only Attar was unaccounted for. From the second list of 19 that the FBI said they found in Attar's hire car, seven were still alive, and none of them were on the original passenger manifests. Even if you want to still believe all you've been told, then try this small exercise. Imagine just for one moment if Mohammed Attar's identity had been stolen, as we know the other four on the initial FBI list had been. Now how reliable would you find this second list of 19 suspects apparently found in his car? This is exactly what the Daily Telegraph reported in England on the 23rd of September 2001. Headlined, "Revealed, the men with stolen identities." Their names were flashed around the world as suicide hijackers who carried out the attacks on America. But yesterday, four innocent men told how their identities had been stolen. The men, all from Saudi Arabia, spoke of their shock at being mistakenly named by the FBI as suicide terrorists. None of the four was in the United States on September the 11th, and all are still alive in their home country. The Telegraph obtained the first interviews with the men since they learned that they were on the FBI's list of hijackers who all died in crashes in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. All four said they were outraged to be identified as terrorists. One of them has never even been to America, and another is a Saudi Arabian pilot who was on a training course in Tunisia at the time of the attacks. Saudi Airlines has said it was considering legal action against the FBI for seriously damaging its reputation and that of its pilots. And finally, in respect of the pilot hijackers, there is one last important piece of known evidence, and that is none of them could have flown those planes on 9/11 anyway. Experts have now studied their backgrounds and the training they apparently received and read their evaluations, and they were all found to be underskilled and underqualified. Extensive tests have been performed in flight simulators, and you cannot find a pilot anywhere who will agree that any of the people on the FBI list that made up the 9/11 Commission report could have flown those four aircraft on 9/11 in the manner in which we have been told they did. Hundreds, if not thousands, of pilots have used simulators to try and recreate the flight patterns of both jets that hit the Twin Towers, and none of them have managed to hit the target first time. Some pilots with 20,000 hours of experience have needed three or four attempts. Go to the Pilots for 9/11 Truth website for more information. Don't take my word for it. It's easy to do your own research. Instead, these four alleged hijackers, the pilots, were novices who had barely learned how to fly small propeller planes. Their instructors described them as only having very poor to below average piloting skills at best. And yet, at their very first attempt behind the controls of a Boeing 757 or 767 on September the 11th, 2001, they were competent enough to fly at altitudes of up to 37,000 feet without any assistance from either a co-pilot or air traffic control. And they successfully navigated into their intended targets. Even though it is possible, in theory, it can only be regarded as somewhere between highly unlikely and impossible. And then multiply that by three. Tony Ferranti, the head of the Federal Aviation Administration's Investigation Division, spent several days after the incidents carefully piecing together the movements of the four aircraft targeted in the attacks. He later revealed that his hair stood on end when he understood the precision with which all four aircraft had to have been flown. Darrell Jenkins, director of the Aviation Institutes at George Washington University, told the New York Times that the pilots who carried out the attacks knew what they were doing down to the very smallest detail. He said that each one of them must have been trained in flying big planes. The Times reported that a number of aviation experts agreed with Jenkins and said that the hijackers must have been experienced pilots. John Nance, an airline pilot, author, and aviation expert, noted that the direct hits on the two towers and on the Pentagon suggested to him the pilots were experienced flyers. Nance pointed to the smooth banking of the second plane to strike the towers and said that precisely controlling an aircraft as large as that near the ground, especially for the Pentagon attack, required highly advanced skills. Nance concluded, "There's no way any amateur could have, with any degree of reliability, done what was done during the 9/11 attacks." Robin Lloyd, a Boeing 737 captain with a British airline, told the Telegraph that the hijackers had to be 100% switched on people. 100% experienced pilots and probably military trained. He said that someone like Osama bin Laden just wouldn't have had access to the pilots of the caliber needed to pull it off. Unlike pilots of the small planes that the four hijackers could barely understand, Boeing 757s and 767s require a vast understanding of navigation techniques and an in-depth knowledge of complicated hydraulic systems, autopilot, and thrust controls. They also have sophisticated glass cockpits with video screens and digital readouts that require an advanced level of computer skills and training to be able to understand and follow. Niki Lauda, the former Formula One world champion, who is also a pilot and owned his own airline, said on German TV that whoever flew the aircraft into the World Trade Center must have been properly trained to fly a plane like that. He said, "You have to know exactly what the turning radius of a plane like that is if I'm trying to hit the World Trade Center." That means these had to be fully trained 757 or 767 pilots. It certainly couldn't be the case that some half-trained pilot tried this somehow, because he wouldn't be able to hit it. In fact, every experienced pilot who is prepared to comment on the flying competence of the 9/11 pilots have all said that the only way they themselves could be certain of hitting those targets was by using the autopilot, which, as we know, was switched off in all four cases. And yet still to this day, the mainstream media publish articles to reinforce the original story in the hope future generations will use that information as a historic fact when doing their own research. George Orwell warned us about this in 1948. Mohammed Atta and Marwar al-Shehhi, allegedly the terrorists who flew American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175 into the World Trade Center, were both mediocre pilots, according to several accounts. They learned to fly between July and December 2000 at a flight school in Venice, Florida. They were enrolled in the school's accelerated pilot program and trained on a Cessna 172, which is a small, single-engine propeller plane. The closest both men came to flying a jet aircraft before September the 11th was the 2 days they spent at the Sim Center Flight School in Opa-locka, Florida, in late December 2000, where they had 6 hours of training in a Boeing 727 simulator. Henry George, the owner of the Sim Center, who trained Atta and al-Shehhi, said the two men were given only mini introductions into jet flight. George found their flying skills to be unremarkable. Hani Hanjour, who was said to be at the controls of Flight 77 and who had the most difficult task in attacking the Pentagon, stood out in flight school training only for his particularly weak flying skills. This 29-year-old Saudi Arabian was described by instructors as a hopeless pilot. The flight school's owner noted in his file that Hanjour was weak and wasting our resources. After being asked to leave that facility, Hanjour joined another where he was assessed as very poor. His knowledge of the academic side of training was weak, his flying skills were marginal, and most significantly, his judgment was very poor. The instructor noted that Hanjour was neither well-educated nor was he intelligent. He also had a poor understanding of the basic principles of aviation and poor technical skills. Another instructor, in early 2001, found Hanjour's piloting skills to be so bad and his understanding of English to be so inadequate that he questioned whether his pilot's license was genuine. He feared Hanjour's skill level to be so poor that he worried he could be a safety hazard at the flight center. Yet another instructor at the time described him as totally useless. I would be amazed if he could have flown that plane into the Pentagon because he couldn't fly at all. In mid-August, 1 month before the attacks, he was assessed as a poor student. He was then refused a request to hire a small light aircraft without further training. All of this only 1 month before he supposedly pulled off one of the greatest flying achievements of all time. At the controls of Flight 93 was the slightly more competent Ziad Jarrah, a 26-year-old from the Lebanon. This one learned to fly during the later part of 2000, having spent 6 months at a flight school in Florida. He trained on a two-seater Cessna 152 propeller plane. The owner of the center described him as average and that we had to do more to get him ready than any of the others. In June of 2001, he had a further 2 flying lessons before he too was refused a higher plane because of his poor flying skills. Herbert Hortman, the owner of the school, told the 9/11 Flight Commission that he was surprised Jarrah had qualified for his pilot's license at all because they considered him to be of limited ability. Hortman also speculated that a flight school with a less than reputable nature might have issued the license. His intended target is thought to have been the White House or Capitol Hill until he was thwarted by the passengers, says the report. But could his target have been World Trade Center Building 7 or another Larry Silverstein building? The Sears Tower in Chicago, perhaps, that was evacuated at 10:02 after a warning that a plane could be heading their way. Now, it is possible, I suppose, that all 4 of these so-called pilots could have had beginner's luck. But if so, this has to be the greatest example of beginner's luck since beginner's luck was first recorded. Or, if not, then the official explanation of the 9/11 attack should be questioned. And this is on top of what we already know about World Trade Center Building 7, the Twin Towers and the men in the suits who could walk through the fire to survival, and the dancing Israelis, and the questionable evidence provided by the US Solicitor General about his wife's phone calls, plus the other phantom phone calls and the 2 aircraft at the Pentagon and in Shanksville that just weren't there for the first reports. Chapter 6. Mohammed Atta, the alleged ringleader. Atta, the scary one with the 1,000-yard stare, had his passport stolen in 1999. He was remembered by his university friends as shy, timid, and uncomfortable with women. Usually they would refrain from drinking and swearing in front of him for fear of upsetting the sensitive soul. So how did this gentle, unpolitical boy from a respected Egyptian family suddenly become the hard-drinking, stripper-loving terrorist that the media and the FBI describe him to be? Atta, or somebody using his identity easily obtained from his stolen passport, registered with a flight school in Florida in 2001. When he cut short his training, he made a point of telling his instructor he was moving to Boston as his reason for leaving. In October 2001, the president of that flight school, Rudy Deckers, gave an interview during which he described Atta as an asshole. This is a transcript of the conversation Deckers had with ABC producer Quentin McDermott. McDermott: why do you say Atta was an asshole? Deckers: well, when Atta was here and I saw his face on several occasions in the building, then I know that they're regular students and I try and communicate with them and talk to them. It's a kind of PR thing. Where are you from? That sort of thing. I found out from my people that he lived in Hamburg and that he spoke German, so being a Dutch citizen myself and fluent in German, I tried to speak to him in German. One morning I simply said in German, "Good morning, how are you? How do you like the coffee? Are you happy here?" And then he looked at me with cold eyes, didn't react at all, and walked away. That was one of the first meetings I had with him. This is similar to the way in which Zacharias Moussaoui, the jailed 20th hijacker, became belligerent and angry when his Minnesota flight instructor tried to communicate with him in his own first language, French, at the beginning of their course. The Minnesota Star Tribune reported on December 21, 2001. Moussaoui first raised his eyebrows when, during a simple introductory exchange, he said he was from France but then didn't seem to understand when the instructor spoke to him in French. Moussaoui then became belligerent and evasive about his background. In addition, he seemed inept at basic flying procedures while seeking expensive training on advanced commercial jet simulators. It's quite the coincidence that Atta and Moussaoui both had American flight instructors who spoke German and French respectively. A coincidence that any conspirator could not have engineered or predicted. The real Atta, of course, should have been able to respond to his instructor's German language, and the real Moussaoui should have been able to speak to his instructor in French. Instead, this Atta just walked away and this Moussaoui became belligerent and angry. Could it be that neither man responded because they were unable to? They didn't speak German and French? Could it be that these two men were not Mohammed Atta and Zacharias Moussaoui after all? Mohammed Atta's own father insists that he spoke to his son on the telephone on September 12, 2001. He's never been seen or heard from since. Israeli agents were arrested in Hollywood, Florida, where Atta was living at the time after carrying out some sort of operation. And when asked where Atta was, his father simply replied, "Ask Mossad." So now we have World Trade Center Building 7, the Twin Towers and the men in suits who walked through the fire to survival. We have the dancing Israelis and the questionable evidence provided by the US Solicitor General about his wife's telephone calls. We have pilots who can't fly aircraft, suspects who were alive after 9/11, and one who was dead before. Chapter 7. The passengers and the crew. There isn't an awful lot known about the passengers and crew of any of the flights on September 11, 2001. And, of course, no contact between passengers and the ground was possible at all unless the planes were also on the ground themselves. But there were communications between two flight attendants, Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney, who were both on Flight 11 out of Boston and heading west. Now, all flight crew are trained to deal with hijacking situations. One of the things they are supposed to do is take off their jackets and hats and sit among the passengers where possible and cover themselves with a coat or blanket. In other words, to look like any other passenger and not flight crew. They should definitely not be standing up and talking for 25 to 30 minutes on an airphone to staff on the ground. However, according to the official report, Betty Ong, a veteran of 14 years flying, placed a call and was connected to Vanessa Minter, an agent at the airline's reservation center in Raleigh. She was also connected to Nadia Gonzalez, whose responsibilities include dealing with security issues via an extension. This call was recorded, and so there is reliable evidence of what was said. Firstly, Ong claimed that the hijackers had used pepper spray in the first-class cabin and that she couldn't get up there. But pepper spray, for obvious reasons, would have been even harder to get through security and onto a plane in hand luggage than a knife or a gun. It was illegal, and impossible to board with. Secondly, as we all know, in a pressurized cabin at 32,000 feet, pepper spray would have spread throughout the aircraft and should have been affecting Miss Ong herself. And then she also said that he is standing on top of the stairs. Now, these small details don't really tell us much about what actually happened to Flights 11 and 175, but they do tell us what didn't happen, and that is that neither of them were hijacked and then pepper-sprayed at altitude, and it tells us that there were stairs somewhere within Miss Ong's range of vision. Betty Ong clearly tells the person she is speaking to he is at the top of the stairs. So, given that there are no stairs on a Boeing 757, Miss Ong must have been on the ground. And the stairs to which she refers to must be the stairs leading off the aircraft or stairs in a hangar. It is not the sort of mistake an experienced flight attendant who sounded calm and focused, albeit stressed, would make. Everything else she says can be shaved away, but factor these two clues into the other evidence we already have about Flight 11. namely the fighter pilot who reported having it on his radar and heading south. Miss Sweeney, for her part, a 13-year flight attendant, reported during her phone call to Michael Woodward, an American Airlines ground security manager, that, "Oh my God, I can see buildings and water." Any experienced flight attendant would be able to recognize New York City as they approached at low altitude on a clear day. She would have been able to provide better information than buildings and water. There are two important details that are freely available to anybody looking in the right place that indicate here that there was no hostage or hijack situation on either of these two planes at the time those calls to the ground were made. In fact, if they were following the proper protocols and procedures, then neither of those two calls would have been made in the first place. It was against the rules. Another thing Sweeney did was identify the hijacker as sitting in seat 9B. Then she came back and changed her mind. "No," she says, "I made a mistake. He's in 10B. Betty Young, meanwhile, was reporting to Vanessa Minter and Nadia Gonzalez that the passenger in 10B has been attacked and is seriously injured. It cannot be overlooked that whilst Betty Young's call to a reservation agent was being recorded, Miss Sweeney's call to one of the airline security managers was not. Instead, Woodward noted down everything she said in shorthand. Neither party on the ground could hear any commotion or hysteria on board. "You didn't hear people screaming," said Minter, which is a little hard to believe. Michael Woodward claimed that Sweeney remained very calm before quietly saying, "Oh my God." Woodward then reported a very, very loud static on the line, and then he stated that he held onto the phone waiting for Sweeney to return as his operational manager walked into his room to tell him that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. He says he failed to make the connection immediately. "I almost, at that point, said to him, 'Not now, we have a very serious situation here.' Although moments later he realized that it was Sweeney's flight was the one that hit the tower. Frankly, that's a little hard to believe as well." So this all leaves us with World Trade Center Building 7, the Twin Towers and the men in suits who can walk through fire, the dancing Israelis, that questionable evidence provided by the US Solicitor General about his wife's phone calls, the suspects who were alive after 9/11 and the one who is dead beforehand, no plane at either the Pentagon or the field in Shanksville, and very, very questionable and contradictory evidence from the airline itself. Sitting in seat 9B on board Flight 11 was Daniel C. Lewin. He was the passenger originally identified as the hijacker by flight attendant Amy Sweeney before she changed her mind and reported that it was the passenger behind him in 10B who was the hijacker. Meanwhile, her colleague Betty Ong was reporting that the passenger in 10B was the one who'd been attacked. Daniel Lewin was an Israeli-American who is reportedly the first victim of 9/11 after he intervened when hijackers attacked flight attendants and tried to enter the cockpit. Early reports from American Airlines Operations Center, based on the unrecorded information from flight attendant Amy Sweeney, stated that he was shot dead at 9:20 a.m., but the plane crashed into the Twin Towers at 8:46 a.m. This was later corrected by the FBI, who confirmed Lewin had been stabbed and left to bleed to death. So why did Amy Sweeney think he'd been shot? Daniel Lewin was also an officer in the Israeli Defense Force, Sayeret Matkal, Israel's most successful special ops unit. Sayeret Matkal is a deep penetration unit who have been involved in assassinations, the theft of foreign signals and intelligence materials, and the theft and destruction of foreign nuclear weaponry. The unit are best known for their daring rescue of 106 Israeli passengers at Entebbe Airport, Uganda, in 1976. In America, Lewin had founded Akamai, a successful computer company, and his connections to Israeli special ops remained hidden until the gun story on Flight 11 became known. The FAA and American airline officials later denied there was a gun on board and agreed with the FBI that Lewin was probably stabbed to death. So, was Daniel Lewin the hijacker, as first reported, or was he the one who was attacked, as was later reported? Was he the one who attacked the passenger sitting behind him in seat 10B, as Betty Young said, or was he the one who was bleeding to death, as was later reported? Or perhaps he was the one who was shot dead, as American Airlines Operations Center first claimed Amy Sweeney had said? Or did he have his throat cut, as the FBI claimed? We will never know, but you can ask yourself if three untrained men armed only with small craft knives could overpower an officer of Sayeret Matkal in close quarter, virtually unarmed combat in the confined space of a first-class cabin on a passenger jet. An art or skill that he'd been highly trained in performing. Hostage rescue is one of their specialities, and the hijackers could only have fought him one at a time in such a small space. The only other Israeli on board either of the planes that crashed into the Twin Towers was Alona Avraham, who was sitting in seat 22G aboard United Airlines Flight 175, According to the Jewish Post, Avraham was an engineer living in Ashdod, Israel. She was a single parent with a 4-year-old son, and her siblings were all, at the time, officers in the Israeli Defense Force. They went on to say that she was only in America to visit her parents in Los Angeles for the 2-week Jewish New Year holidays that began on Tuesday, September the 18th, 2001, but only after stopping in Boston for just a few days. But the truth is that Avraham was an unmarried mother who'd been living in the Boston area for quite some time and was traveling to visit her parents in Los Angeles on September 11 alone. She wasn't taking her only child to visit his grandparents for the Jewish New Year. She'd left him back in Boston. Again, do some thinking and ask yourself, how likely is that? And given that we also know that the 2 aircraft that were flown into the Twin Towers were not Flights 11 and 175, because we've seen those aircraft and they're black or grey and not shiny, clean and white, as passenger jets would be. Now, we've all seen them. Nobody really believes that story about the sunlight and shadows making them appear much darker on television, do they? Watch the footage again and just look at the contrast they have with the gleaming white buildings they fly past and into on that morning. And listen to the recorded first reactions of just about every eyewitness who report dark military-looking planes with no logos, no windows, and much, much more. So this now all adds up to the odd-looking situation at World Trade Center Building 7, the Twin Towers and the men in suits who could walk through a fire hot enough to melt steel and survive, the dancing Israelis, the removal men who appeared to have advanced knowledge, and the very questionable evidence by the US Solicitor General, well, lies, about his wife's phone calls. And there's the new wife, who looks very, very similar to the old one. Pilots who couldn't fly any kind of aircraft. There were suspects who were alive after 9/11, and one was dead beforehand. More questionable and contradictory evidence from the airline itself. Betty Ong and her staircase. No plane at either the Pentagon or in the field at Shanksville. And a captain in the Israeli Defense Force's elite anti-terrorist unit, who was also a hostage rescue specialist, sitting with the hijackers on Flight 11. And there's the 2 dark, windowless, military-looking planes at the Twin Towers. Chapter 8. The Flight Interruption System. During the early 1990s, Boeing bought and began installing a simple plug-in device for the onboard flight computer systems called the Flight Termination System. It had been developed as a response to the famous D.B. Cooper hijacking of 1971, the only successful hijacking in aviation history in the sense that D.B. Cooper got away with it. United Airlines called it the Flight Interruption System. Effectively, this was a remote-controlled device developed by a company called SPC International, the CEO of which was a Rabbi Dov S. Zakim. He also happened to be the Undersecretary of Defense, the comptroller, between 2001 and 2004 during George W. Bush's first administration, and, of course, on September the 11th, 2001. SPC International sold the remote control system on the basis that in the event of a hijacking, engineers on the ground could take over the controls of the aircraft and program it to head for any location where they could be liberated by a hostage rescue team. It is the same technology used so successfully in operating drones. So given that this technology had been available for a decade prior to September the 11th, 2001, you have to ask yourself why it wasn't employed in respect of the 4 hijacked aircraft on that day. Or the bigger question, of course, is, well, was it? Because then there would be no need for all those suicide hijackers who were still alive the following day and couldn't fly planes anyway. Let's think about everything we actually know and that we're not speculating about. What have we seen for ourselves? And then you can see how easy the whole 9/11 operation would have been if those 4 planes were taken over remotely and flown into their destinations, or even switched with military drones mid-flight. One man with a laptop could do it, with the cooperation of air traffic control, who were by then bringing every plane down at the nearest airports. Thousands of them. It's just a thought. Now, for those of you listening to this who are about to start dismissing me as a conspiracy theorist after all, then go and do some of your own research. Rabbi Dov Zakheim's own company, SPC International, introduces the flight termination system on its official website like this. The Flight Termination System, the FTS, is a fully redundant turnkey range safety and test system for remote control and flight termination of airborne vehicles. You can go to the SPC website and read all about it. So now we have World Trade Center Building 7, the Twin Towers and the men in suits who can walk through fire. We have the dancing Israelis and the questionable evidence provided by the US Solicitor General. We have pilots who couldn't fly, suspects who are alive after 9/11 and the one who was dead before. Very questionable and contradictory evidence from the airline itself, Betty Ong and her staircase, no planes at the Pentagon or in Shanksville, and the captain of the Israeli Defense Forces elite anti-terrorist unit, who was a hostage rescue specialist, was sitting with the hijackers on Flight 11. And the two dark, windowless, military-looking planes at the Twin Towers, or were they drones? And now we even have the American-Israeli Secretary for Defense in his own company's flight interruption system for remotely controlling passenger jets in case of hijack. They can remotely take over any plane and fly it anywhere they choose to, such as into a building.
Chapter 9. The Israeli Art Students. In January 2001, the US Drug Enforcement Agency started receiving unusual reports from its field offices all over America. Young Israelis, it was being submitted, were claiming to be art students and touring the country offering their work for sale. Unusually, there seemed to be a large number of Drug Enforcement Agency agents and other senior federal officials who were approached at their private residences and offered special deals on this artwork at the front door. Reports were also submitted by DEA offices and defense agencies and law enforcement facilities. The students, it appeared, only wanted to sell their art to top-secret facilities or members of staff at their homes. The DEA noted the emerging pattern, which began to include FBI agents, and concluded that the DEA appeared to have been targeted in what was called an organized intelligence gathering activity. But at that time, nobody understood why or for whom it was being carried out. Further reports came in throughout the first 6 months of 2001 from over 40 US cities and more than 130 separate incidents of art student encounters, as they became known, were documented involving the US Marshal Services, the ATF, the US Air Force, the Secret Service, the FBI, and the DEA themselves. Some of the students were seen sketching the inside of federal buildings after they had gained access to innocently sell pictures to employees. Others were found to have photographs of individual federal agents, and one had a computer printout of DEA groups. On many occasions, the students visited facilities and agencies so secret they were not even known to the American public. These are located in areas without street names and with only unidentified discrete buildings. This confirmed to US authorities that information had already been gathered beforehand and that there was a major infiltration being attempted. One of the young students was discovered to have bank receipts close to $200,000, which he claimed to have been the result of art sales. One of the groups, it was later noted, had lived for some time in the small town of Hollywood, Florida, very close to Mohammed Attar. In March 2001, the CIA issued a warning to all federal employees about the students and informed them that two had been arrested for trespassing and then found to have counterfeit work visas and green cards. Immediately after the warning, officials began dealing more aggressively with the students. According to one account, 140 Israeli nationals were either detained or arrested between March 2001 and September 11, 2001. Many of them were deported. None of the students were enrolled in the art colleges they claimed to be, and some of them didn't even exist. At the time, the media were generally led to believe that the students were Arabs posing as Israelis and looking for potential targets. Incredibly, the story died down and was rarely even mentioned. However, after 9/11, reporter Carl Cameron did start investigating the story and was told by one US intelligence officer that the art students were aspiring who were possibly observing Al-Qaeda members during the months leading up to September the 11th. But he was also told quite abruptly that evidence linking these Israelis to 9/11 is classified. I cannot tell you about the evidence gathered as it's classified information. Cameron's explosive story was then scuttled by the major news networks as their sources inside the Justice Department and the FBI laughed it off as a fantasy, and it then died in his arms. It would only resurface later again in Europe. However, inside the DEA, they already knew they had a major problem. The fact that foreign nationals had the home addresses of their agents was only the start of it. The Israeli embassy, for their part, denied everything. Spokesman Mark Reguev, who had later lied about the dancing Israelis, said, "No American official or intelligence agency has complained to us about this. This story is nonsense. Israel does not spy on the United States." There are a number of theories as to what the Israeli students were actually doing. One is that they were trying to infiltrate a known ecstasy smuggling ring being run by Israeli nationals. Another is that Mossad was simply training a new group of recruits in field operations, both of which would seem unlikely. However, yet another suggestion is that they could be simply a smokescreen, a cover for another, real operation.
In May 2000, the Lower Manhattan Cultural Arts Program, who occupied floors 90 and 91 of the World Trade Center Tower 1, invited an Israeli art project known as Gelatin to share building space with them. 14 art students then moved on to the 90th floor, where they set up tents and were issued with construction worker passes which gave them access to the trade areas of the building. The group of 14 then created a project known as the B-Thing, which involved removing a window on the 90th floor and installing a temporary balcony. That was about it. Just a small wooden balcony which was then photographed from a rented helicopter. In August 2001, Gelatin published a booklet describing Project B, which included some text and obviously many behind-the-scenes photographs. In some of these photographs, the artists are pictured clearly wearing rappelling harnesses and there are fixed abseiling ropes hanging from a ceiling. Project B did not involve anybody climbing down the building. In another photograph, rows and rows of boxes can be seen lined along a rear wall with the mark BB18 stamped on each one. Product BB18 are fuse holders that can be used for demolition charges. Why would the art students need them for their project? Throughout the booklet, all of the art students are only pictured facing away from the camera, although not exactly concealing their identities, or at least not very well, because one of them has been identified as Hanan Serfati, an Israeli military intelligence officer and bomb expert. It was Serfati who rented two Hollywood apartments close to Mohammed Attar and four of the other named suspects. He was later identified as the same man who had moved nearly $200,000 around during the first quarter of 2001, explaining it away as proceeds from successful art sales. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory. These are the facts, and they're very easy to check for yourselves. We don't know what caused the collapse of the Twin Towers, but we do know what did not. So research Project B by the Gelatin Art Group and see for yourselves. Finally, there is just one more thing to think about, but it really is just a detail that may prove important one day. Or it may not. Those BB18 fuse holders are supplied by the Lytel Fuse Company in Chicago, a subsidiary of Tracer Company, a government contractor based in Austin, Texas. Tracer also owned a company called Vitro, formerly known as Kellex Corporation and now known as Halliburton. That's the company owned by the former Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, and the company who made $40 billion profit on the Iraq War alone. So just to recap, we now have the World Trade Center Building 7 and that suspicious collapse. We have the Twin Towers and the men in suits who can walk through fire. The dancing Israelis, the questionable evidence provided by the US Solicitor General about his wife's phone calls. Pilots who could not fly the aircraft, suspects who were alive after 9/11 and one who was dead beforehand. Very questionable and contradictory evidence from the airline itself. Betty Ong and her staircase. No plane at either the Pentagon or the field in Shanksville. And a captain in the Israeli Defense Forces elite anti-terrorist unit who was a hostage rescue specialist sitting with the hijackers on Flight 11. And there are the two dark windowless military-looking planes at the Twin Towers. We even have the American-Israeli Secretary for Defense and his company's flight interruption system for remotely controlling passenger jets in the case of hijack. And now there are 140 arrested Israelis who are posing as art students in what appeared to be an intelligence-gathering operation. And who can ignore the thousands of BB-18 fuse holders on the 90th floor of the World Trade Center where an Israeli art group were carrying out a project that involved removing a window and abseiling equipment? The evidence is right there and available to anybody looking for it. Chapter 10. Dick Cheney. In the documentary program, The World According to Dick Cheney, he said, "I got on the telephone with the president who was in Florida and told him not to be at one location where we could both be taken out." Cheney then kept the president aimlessly in the air on 9/11 while he and his wife left by helicopter for a secure, undisclosed location. This left Washington in silence with nobody addressing the nation on that morning. He was later asked, "Now you and the president had earlier discussed the rules of engagement for taking down a hijacked airplane. But you were the one who gave the direct order to shoot down a plane you were told, as it turns out incorrectly, to be heading for Washington." Cheney immediately replied, "Right, that's correct." He then discusses the first three attacks at the Twin Towers and Pentagon and adds, "And if we had been in a position to intercept one of those to keep it from striking its target, would we do so? Absolutely. And what I did was pass on the president's approval of the basic proposition that would in fact authorize our people to shoot down aircraft that had been hijacked and refused to divert." Vice President Dick Cheney later testified the same thing to the 9/11 Commission, and President Bush supported this version in his testimony. But the Commission found no documentary evidence that this call took place at all. Do you think there would be no transcript? Would Cheney not want to make sure there was a record of it? It was such a monumental order to shoot down a passenger jet full of citizens. Would you want a record of it if you'd been passed something like that to do? If your boss ordered you to go out and put rat poison down outside your building where you knew the cats from next door played, would you want a record of it? According to the 9/11 Commission report, there is no record of Bush passing Cheney the order to shoot. But the same report went on to say that Flight 93, the fourth, crashed after heroic Americans tried to save the country. Well, the White House or Capitol Hill, so it doesn't matter anyway, does it? Yes, it does. Because Cheney also says during this documentary that he gave the instructions that we'd authorize our pilots to take it out, meaning Flight 93. And then he said, after I'd given the order, it was pretty quiet. Everybody heard it, and it was obviously a significant moment. In other words, Cheney lied that Bush had authorized a shoot-down order, but he later admitted this when being confronted with irrefutable evidence. But this fact alone should be reason enough to reopen or restart the 9/11 Commission, never mind World Trade Center Building 7, the dancing Israelis, and all the rest. The former Vice President of the United States goes on film and admits that he gave the order to shoot down Flight 93, and yet there is still no new inquiry. What else has Dick Cheney lied about? Well, for a start, he immediately and falsely linked the 9/11 attacks to Iraq. Now, the entire torture program in Guantanamo Bay was geared towards proving such a link, and Cheney was the central figure in pressuring the Justice Department lawyers to write memos declaring torture to be legal under the Constitution. He addressed Congress in an attempt to justify torture, and the former director of the CIA, Stansfield M. Turner, said that Cheney oversaw American torture policies and procedures. When all this information became public in 2012 as a result of a Senate report, there were new calls for former Bush administration or CIA officials to be prosecuted for the torture program they oversaw. But Cheney dismissed an appeal from Ben Emmerson, the UN special reporter on counter-terrorism and human rights, to reopen the inquiries. He said, "I have little respect for the United Nations or for this individual who doesn't have a clue." Another former director of the CIA, John Brennan, described the torture program as abhorrent. Cheney replied, "I have no problem with that as long as we achieve our objective." At least four detainees later testified that they had said anything they were told to say in order to make the torture stop. Some even signed confessions that they were not even allowed to read. Cheney certainly did achieve his objective and had Iraq in his sights. The Patriot Act, the War on Terror, the Afghanistan War, the War in Iraq, and the future war in Iran are all justified by the attacks on 9/11. Even though some of them had begun before, they still badly needed justifying. And all of those targets are sworn enemies of Israel. In fact, regime change in Iraq, Libya, Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran were all planned a decade before 9/11. Do your own research. You can look it up on the public record. So now we have the Vice President caught lying multiple times. The same man who was the CEO of Halliburton, the company who made $40 billion from government contracts during the 9/11-inspired Iraq war alone. The same company that owned the company that owned the company that made the detonator fuses BB-18 seen at the Twin Towers during the Israeli Art Group's B project on the 90th floor. Larry Silverstein, World Trade Center 7, 3,000-degree heat that humans can walk through in the Twin Towers. Israeli Special Ops Forces on Flights 11 and 175, hijacker pilots who couldn't fly, flight termination systems developed by Rabbi Gov Zakheim's company, and all of the other known facts. In his autobiography, In My Time, a personal and political memoir, which Cheney cynically released on the 10th anniversary of September the 11th, the Times reviewed it as a memoir in which Cheney describes a world where he was a lone, courageous visionary surrounded by cowards and imbeciles. He said that CIA Director George Tenet's decision to resign when the going got tough was unfair on the president, and he takes credit for pushing out Colin Powell after the 2004 election. Cheney also threw Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice under the bus for trying to form a nuclear arms agreement with North Korea, and even describes how Rice sat tearfully in his office and admitted he'd been right all along. Cheney went on to defend what he called tough interrogation methods, although the rest of us still call that torture. And it was also Cheney who was involved in the domestic spying program that subjected all Americans on U.S. soil to having their telephone calls listened to and their emails read without warrants required by the U.S. law. And if all of that's not enough, he is also the driving force behind wars in the Middle East that have cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent people and led to the mass displacement of tens of millions more, the backlash of which Europe is still suffering the consequences and will be for many years to come. Chapter 11. Donald Rumsfeld. The US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz were having breakfast meeting with Representatives Christopher Cox and John Meeker and numerous others, which began at 8 a.m. on September the 11th, 2001. The meeting was held in Rumsfeld's private Pentagon dining room, and they were discussing missile defense systems. Rumsfeld later recalled, "I had said during an 8 o'clock breakfast meeting that sometime in the next 2, 6, 8, 10, 12 months there would be an event that would occur in the world that would be sufficiently shocking that it would remind people again how important it is to have a strong, healthy defense department that contributes to and underpins peace and stability in our world. The first plane was to hit the Twin Towers before that meeting finished." According to John Meeker, the subject of Donald Rumsfeld's interest was that the military had been downsized during the 1990s since the fall of the Berlin Wall, and what we were going to do about the situation if we had another, the word Rumsfeld used was incident. And he was trying to make certain that we were prepared for something that we might not expect. Meeker added, "Little did we know that within a few minutes of the end of our conversation, and actually before the end of our breakfast, that our world would change and the incident we were talking about would actually be happening." Immediately on hearing the news of the first attack on the Twin Towers, Rumsfeld said, "Well, I've been around the block a few times and I can tell you there will be more attacks coming." By the way of record, Rumsfeld's meeting ended at 8:50 a.m. The first plane hit the Twin Towers at 8:46, and in those first shocking few minutes, possibly even until the second one, most people still thought it might have been an accident. In which case, how did Rumsfeld seem to know there would be more attacks coming during the first 4 minutes of what appeared to be an accident? I don't know, and I don't want to speculate. I just give you the recorded facts and not my own theories. Within seconds of the Pentagon being hit, Rumsfeld rushed out of his office and headed towards the crash site. Officer Aubrey Davis, who was Rumsfeld's bodyguard, reached the site at the same time. He said there were flames and bits of metal all around. The secretary picked up one of the pieces of metal, and I was telling him he shouldn't be interfering with a crime scene. When he looked at some inscription on it, he said, "American Airlines." Now, as we know from Dan Rather's first live report for CNN, which you can watch for yourselves on YouTube, no, there wasn't, and no, he couldn't have done. Then, according to Rumsfeld himself, a person who'd witnessed the attack on the Pentagon informed him that a plane had flown into it. Rumsfeld later said, "I saw people on the grass, and we just tried to put them in stretchers and then move them out across the grass towards the road and lifted them over a wall so people on that side could put them in the ambulances. I was out there for a while, and then other people arrived and took over. There were people lying on the grass with clothes blown off and burns all over them." Have a look again at Dan Rather's live report from directly in front of the Pentagon on September the 11th, 2001. Rumsfeld also claimed to have saved the life of budget analyst Paul Gonzalez by pulling him to safety from the burning building. Gonzalez later offered his own detailed recollections of pulling other people to safety, but there's no mention of Rumsfeld at all. And Rumsfeld claimed to have been helping to load other people onto stretchers for at least 15 minutes or until others arrived to take over. Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs Victoria Clark later said that Rumsfeld was gone from his office for about half an hour, which, given the considerable distance between his desk and the crash site and back again, would mean he could only have been there for no longer than a minute or two. However, perhaps the most revealing information we should have when it comes to Donald Rumsfeld and his character can be found in now declassified documents that show the Bush administration wanted Saddam Hussein out of Iraq and were ready to start a war to ensure that happened. Within a few hours of the 9/11 attacks, Rumsfeld was meeting with Air Force General Richard Myers in the Pentagon, and notes were taken by Rumsfeld's assistant Steve Camborn. These are the notes referred to on pages 334 and 5 on the 9/11 Commission report. These notes reveal the Secretary for Defense, Rumsfeld, asking for the best info and fast. Judge whether good enough to hit SH, meaning Saddam Hussein, at the same time, not only Osama bin Laden. Rumsfeld later asked Jim Haynes, the Pentagon's top lawyer, to talk to PW, being Paul Wolfowitz, for additional support for the connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Need to move swiftly, go massive, go deep, sweep all things up, related or not. And this was all at a time when there was no evidence at all of what had happened at the Twin Towers or the Pentagon, and certainly nothing linking the attack to either bin Laden or Saddam Hussein, evil as they were. Even so, Donald Rumsfeld was already looking for ways to justify war on Iraq on that very first morning. It's in the records. It's in the government's own records. According to the now declassified talking points agenda from the sessions, now even accessible on YouTube, that by late November, Rumsfeld was meeting with General Tommy Franks, the CENTCOM commander, to plan the decapitation of the Iraqi government. The discussion suggests that Rumsfeld and his team were struggling with the problem of how to start. In other words, what would be the pretext for war? Several suggestions were made, noted down, and later appeared in a leaked memo. Number 1. US discovers Saddam connection to September 11 attack or to anthrax attacks? Question mark. Number 2. Dispute over weapons of mass destruction inspections? Question mark. Number 3. Start now thinking about inspection demands. All of this suggests that Donald Rumsfeld was using the 9/11 attacks to go to war with Iraq over. Attacks which is starting to look like many, many people had advanced knowledge of. Chapter 12. Other surprising information, starting with the Otis Air Force Base. On the morning of September 11, 2001, military reservists stationed at the Otis Air Force Base in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, were activated. But when they arrived, they discovered the base had been evacuated and they were locked out. They were then checked into hotels and told to wait, which they did for 3 or 4 days before being sent home again. None of them were ever told why or what had happened, including senior officers. The base was simply locked down. Otis Air Force Base is a reserve base that is usually home to a C-5 transport unit, which is a fleet of very large cargo planes, much larger than regular passenger jets. There are 5 giant aircraft hangars lined up along the runway, easily large enough to house a Boeing 757 or 767. And each hangar has a staircase in at least 2 corners leading up to a mezzanine level and the office suites. Think again about Betty Yong and her phone call. This is a sworn testimony. My name is Sarah Swain. Now I've changed that name to protect the innocent. And I was living in Otis, Massachusetts on September 11, 2001. At around 8:30, 8:45 in the morning, I saw a United Airlines plane fly over my house. At the time, I was shocked because the plane was very, very low and I could see the people in the windows. I was standing on a deck on the 2nd floor and watching the plane fly over the top of the house. Then I lost sight of it because of the way the building is. But I think it was flying north. After I lost sight of it, I was speaking to my neighbour and we were just amazed at how low the plane was. I shouldn't say height, I mean altitude. It was just so low that we were flabbergasted. Now, I know it was 8:30 or 8:45 at the latest because I had to get to an appointment in the next town and I needed to be there by 9:30. And so I left about 5 minutes after I saw the plane and headed towards Great Barrington. She went on to say that she was certain that when she got out of her appointment, she was going to hear about a plane crash north of Otis. And then there was the FBI. In 2001, the director of the FBI was Robert Mueller, who would later find worldwide attention through his irrational witch hunt of President Donald Trump following the 2016 presidential elections. However, on September 21, 2001, Mueller readily admitted that some of the identities of the hijackers were still open to question. According to him, stealing the identities of others would be relatively easy given their level of sophistication. Leaving aside for a moment the idea that the hijackers' level of sophistication is what should be really in question, then Robert Mueller's comments pose the question that we actually should be asking. And that is that if Osama bin Laden was really involved in attempting to cover his tracks, then why would Al-Qaeda steal the identities of fellow Saudi Arabians that would lead directly back to him? If they were sophisticated in any way at all, they would have stolen the identities of Israelis or Russians or anybody else that would suit him to blame. But stolen identities that lead directly back to him reveal the level of sophistication of a moron, either in his own case or in the case of whoever was trying to frame him. Also, it reveals the level of sophistication of anybody who believes anything Robert Mueller has to say about 9/11. He is the man who originally admitted some of the men suspected to be involved were using false identities but continued to use those names and photographs of entirely innocent and still alive men. And the mainstream US media also continued to use them. We don't see any other country's media doing that anymore. And on this very subject of false and stolen identities, it's helpful to understand how the secret services of some countries go about their shady business. On January 12, 2000, Indian intelligence officers arrested 11 men in Calcutta who were about to board a flight to Dakar. They were posing as Muslim preachers and were detained on suspicion of being hijackers, but were soon released. Leading Indian news magazine, The Week, reported, "The 11 supposed Muslim preachers all have Israeli passports but were believed to be Afghan nationals who had spent some time in Iran." Indian intelligence officers, too, were surprised by the nationality profile of the 11. "They say they have been on a tablar in India for 2 months, but they are Israeli nationals from the West Bank," said a central intelligence official. He claimed that Tel Aviv exerted considerable pressure on Delhi to secure their release. It appeared that they could be working for a sensitive organization in Israel and were on a mission to Bangladesh, the official said. So the dancing Israelis were not the first to be caught posing as Islamic fundamentalists in a major city. And the connection with India and its intelligence network is strengthened when we read this short report from Express India, published on April 3, 2002. Washington, April 3. Indian intelligence agencies helped the US to identify the hijackers who carried out the deadly September 11 terror attacks in New York and Washington, a media report said here on Wednesday. The Indian Intelligence Agency, who have a close relationship with the Israeli Intelligence Agency thanks to their mutual hatred of Pakistan, close enough to release 11 of them soon as they found out who they were, helped the FBI identify the 19 terror suspects. So perhaps it was not the list found in Mohammed Atta's car after all that revealed their identities, stolen or otherwise, as FBI Director Robert Mueller has always insisted. Osama bin Laden. Immediately following the attacks, the mass media was filled with stories linking them to bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. TV talking heads and journalists fed the frightened American public with some of the most outrageous propaganda we have seen since 1946. But bin Laden himself strongly denied any involvement. We were then shown grainy, barely audible amateur video that was apparently found lying around in a cave in Afghanistan of bin Laden admitting to the terrorist act and celebrating it. Celebrate he probably did, but admit to it he did not. Instead, he, and I suppose rather predictably, pointed the finger towards Israel and mounting evidence that Mossad had been busy framing Arabs for terror plots against America in the hope of provoking a deadly and decisive response. And if that were true, well then they certainly achieved that.
Chapter 13. The Victims. As far as the victims of the attacks on the Twin Towers are concerned, we had been repeatedly told that no human remains were recovered, and then, on the other hand, there are records of funerals. USA Today reported that the remains of Alona Avraham, a 30-year-old Israeli on vacation in the US and who was on Flight 175, had been returned to Israel for burial. Which is a good thing, right? Well, no, not really. Because although we already know the fires were not burning at a temperature high enough to damage the steel structures, thanks to the existence of the survivors from the higher floors who walked through them to safety, and the later discovery of human bones, such as the ones linked to Avraham, then we also know that the indestructible black boxes could not have been lost, the most durable material known to man against a human shin bone. So, where is the data? The official report can't have it both ways, and yet it insists it will. And clearly there are hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of body parts here that we could consider, but why waste the time? This one example is quite enough to support the evidence of the men in suits walking through the fire that was, obviously, nowhere near to the temperature required to melt steel and that could not have weakened the structures of the buildings. There have since been thousands of studies, tests and experiments by scientific experts and metal fatigue engineers, demolition experts and not to mention structural engineers and architects. You can check out their work at the Architects and Engineers for Truth website. All of it confirms that the three Larry Silverstein buildings, World Trade Centers 1, 2 and 7, could not have collapsed into their own footprint in the fashion that they did without being wired for controlled demolition. We already know they did not come down as a result of fire because human beings cannot walk through a fire or sit around wondering what to do for the next 20 minutes on an office floor that is burning at 3,000 degrees. We don't really need scientific or engineering experts to tell us this, I don't think. It's nice to have, but we should already know this for ourselves by now. We can do our own experiments. Go and put your hand into a 300-degree oven and see if you can hold it for 20 minutes. And then imagine that times 10. And then come back and dismiss me as a conspiracy theorist. That single piece of evidence alone should be enough to convince you that 9/11 did not happen as a result of an Al-Qaeda plot against American freedom and liberties. Cavemen do not have access to the nanothermite that was found in the wreckage of each building. And that is the only explosive capable of running hot enough to melt steel down into pools of molten metal seen in the debris by the rescue workers, and indeed on early television footage. And also because Al-Qaeda are too stupid to carry out such a coordinated attack. So too with the Bush administration. They would never have got away with it. Too many people would have given the game away. No American administration could have organized such a thing and kept it a secret. The Clinton administration couldn't even keep the whereabouts of his penis a secret. One of the most important things in such an investigation, as with any murder investigation, is to work out a motive. Discover the motive and you will surely get your man. And by motive, it means who has the most to gain. And that is not bin Laden or Al-Qaeda, who knew they would immediately be blown away or at the very least be on the run for the rest of their lives. Look how they ran immediately into the caves of Tora Bora. They knew what was coming, and where are they now? And George Bush didn't have much to gain either. Despite being a militant Christian, I believe him to be a decent man, albeit way out of his depth. And it wasn't the American people either who have endured untold suffering since September the 11th, 2001. Thousands have lost loved ones. Thousands have lost homes and businesses. Everybody has lost their freedom of movement and true liberty, the very thing America once stood for. It's not the Arab nations either. Look at the mess over there. And certainly not the Europeans, who are suffering the backlash with millions of fleeing Arabs surging over their borders, many of whom have bad intentions for the future. And it's not the Russians or the Chinese. What have they gained? Who is it then, in your opinion and not mine, who has gained the most from the events of 9/11? Who displayed the motive? Who are proven to have been involved at every level and on every turn, somewhere and somehow? Who appear in every story that is connected to all the known facts, even if we're not sure how or why? Who have had their sworn enemies in the shape of Saddam Hussein, the Taliban and Gaddafi silenced by the American backlash? And with Syria and Iran surely to follow suit, at the time of writing. Who has benefited from the regime changes all across the Middle East? Look closely again at World Trade Center Building 7 and the important smoking gun, the Twin Towers and the men in suits who walked through the fire to survival, the dancing Israelis and the questionable evidence provided by the US Solicitor General about his wife's phone calls, and the pilots who couldn't fly the aircraft, suspects who were alive after 9/11 and one who was dead long beforehand, very questionable and contradictory evidence from the airline itself, Betty Ong and that staircase, no plane at either the Pentagon or in the field in Shanksville, and the captain in the Israeli Defense Force's elite anti-terrorist unit who was a hostage rescue specialist, sitting with the hijackers on Flight 11. And then there are those two dark, windowless, military-looking planes at the Twin Towers. And we even have the American-Israeli Secretary for Defense and his company's flight interruption systems for remotely controlling passenger jets in case of a hijack. And remember those thousands of BB-18 fuse holders on the 90th floor of the World Trade Center where an Israeli art group were carrying out a project that involved removing a window and abseiling equipment? There are at least two senior American politicians lying about their involvement. The suspicious goings-on at the Otis Air Force Base. Architects and engineers for truth. Pilots for 9/11 truth. Israelis posing as Arabs in India. And the nanothermite found in the debris of the World Trade Center attacks that could not be possibly linked to Al-Qaeda. Any single one of these pieces of known proven evidence should be enough to make us question the official inquiry, but taken together, as Sherlock Holmes says, then you must find the truth, however improbable that seems. We can work out for ourselves who benefited the most and who has suffered the most, and then decide if Bin Laden coordinated all of this from a cave. Don't get me wrong here, he had done some terrible things and needed taking out before he did any more, but 9/11 was not one of them. We can do our own thinking, our own research. We don't have to rely on Fox News, the BBC or CNN or the 9/11 Commission report. We can draw our own conclusions from the known facts. The only question then is, what does the New World Order have in store for us all next? This has been Albert Jack reading 9/11 Conspiracy and the call for a new inquiry.
More of my audiobooks can be found at albertjack.co.uk.